Hachette Audio presents Zombie Fugitive, written by Darren Chan, read by Emma Galvin. Then, Becky Smith's journey into darkness and pain began when a zombie ripped her heart from her chest, and she became one of the walking, brain-eating undead. Months later, she recovered consciousness. As a child, she had been injected with a vaccine by someone working for a century-old scientist named Dr. Oystein, and that had bestowed her with the ability to regain her senses. After a spell of captivity in an underground complex, Bea was set free by the nightmarish Mr. Dowling, a mad, vicious clown who was backed by an army of mutants. He killed gleefully wherever he went, but for some reason he let Bea walk away unharmed. Bea found her way to Dr. Oystein's base in County Hall, where she became one of his angels, a team of revitalized teenage zombies. The doctor had been forced by the Nazis to create the zombie virus, and he believed he was on a mission from God to make amends and help mankind overcome this most hideous of threats. The doctor told Bea that he had subsequently created another pair of viruses that were the key to the outcome of the war between the living and the undead. One was a dark red liquid, called Clemens 13, which would wipe out every zombie on the face of the planet within a couple of weeks if released. The other was Schlesinger 10, a milky white substance that would have an equally fast fatal impact on humans if it was uncorked. Dr. Oystein couldn't use Clemens 13 to eliminate the undead forces, because Mr. Dowling had stolen a vial of Schlesinger 10 from his laboratory with the help of his ally, the mysterious Owl Man. The clown could unleash the virus on humanity if the doctor forced his hand, just as Dr. Oystein could crack open his vial of Clemens 13 if Mr. Dowling ever attacked him. The pair were locked in a stalemate, and the world looked like it would suffer indefinitely because of it. The angels did whatever they could to help the survivors of the zombie apocalypse, but their ultimate goal was to track down Mr. Dowling's supply of Schlesinger 10. If they retrieve the vial from the killer clown, Dr. Oystein could bring his sample of Clemens 13 into play and deliver the world from its undead menace in one fell swoop. When Bea was captured by a hunter named Barnes, an ex-soldier from America, who was an expert when it came to killing or capturing zombies, destiny set her on course for a showdown with Mr. Dowling. Barnes was working for the board, a group of rich and powerful humans who had granted his son a place on an island where zombies couldn't attack him. In return for this favor, Barnes was obliged to hand Bea over to the board, whose members gleefully passed the time by watching her duel to the death with other zombies. A repentant Barnes later helped Bea escape before setting off to rescue his son, whose safety was no longer guaranteed now that his father had betrayed his foul employers. But Bea wasn't finished with the board, and again ended up in their clutches months later. The most twisted of their party was the fiendish Dandan, who strapped her down in his quarters in Battersea Power Station and proceeded to pick her body apart as painfully as he could. It looked as if Bea's time was up, but, to her shock, Mr. Dowling charged to her rescue. Aided by his mutants and a team of lethal, genderless babies, he swarmed the power station and freed her. The clown's babies carried Bea deep underground to Mr. Dowling's lair, where he patched her fragile carcass back together. She found out that the babies had been cloned from her DNA, making her their virtual mother. The clown wanted her to marry him and rule by his side, so that they could eventually replace humanity with their eerie offspring. Bea wasn't interested in playing the wedding game with Mr. Dowling, but, as he shared his memories with her, she began to feel sorry for him. He had been a decent man once, until something dreadful happened and cast him into a state of insane chaos. When Mr. Dowling promised to stop killing if Bea married him, she bowed to his wishes, hoping it might signal the start of his recovery. After a warped but oddly sweet ceremony, the pair retired to their wedding chamber, where the clown granted her access to his innermost thoughts. It should have been a peaceful, loving time, but Bee found herself instinctively smashing through Mr. Dowling's mental defenses. Without having planned it, she pinpointed the location of his vial of Schlesinger 10. The betrayed clown tried to kill her, and the pair fought fiercely. Bee got the better of her husband, but before she could finish him off, the enraged baby stormed the room and ripped into her. They would have killed her, but one of their own, Holy Moly, a baby with a hole in its head, reminded them that Bee was their mummy. Confused, they let her go, and she set off through the underground lair, wounded and alone, in search of the vial that would ensure victory for mankind if she could deliver it safely into the hands of Dr. Oystein, but all too aware that time was against her, and that Mr. Dowling and his mutants would surely execute her if they caught up. 1. Now. I left Mr. Dowling unconscious. I zapped him with enough electricity to put a normal person out of action for a whole day. But the clown is far from normal, and I can't bank on him staying down for too long. I reckon I might have as little as an hour or two before he stirs and calls for help. Maybe less if Kinslow or one of his other mutants comes to check on him. Time, as they say, is of the essence. The trouble is, the shape I'm in at the moment, I'd struggle to win a race with a snail. Although Mr. Dowling repaired the worst of the damage, I hadn't fully recovered from Dandan's mauling by the time of my wedding. The babies reopened lots of old wounds when they attacked me, and inflicted plenty of new ones. Every step is agony. The recently restored flesh of my stomach has been clawed away. Most of my replacement ribs have been snapped off. Bones are broken. I'm bleeding all over. Thick, gloopy blood, slowly oozing from my injuries. I didn't think there was that much of the crimson stuff left. Dandan drained off lots of it while he was torturing me, but there must have been hidden reserves. I'll have to do something about the blood. The loss won't really harm me, but if I don't stop it, I'll leave a trail that even a blind mutant will be able to follow. Still, I can't worry about that until I locate the vial of Schlesinger 10. If Mr. Dowling recovers sooner than I anticipate, he'll know exactly where I'm going, and he'll set the mutants on me. No point wasting time. My priority has to be to lay my hands on the vial. Only then can I start planning my next move. I stagger along, picking my way from room to room, through the maze that Mr. Dowling and his assistants have built over the years. If this wasn't the day of my wedding, there'd be mutants relaxing, working and patrolling the corridors, even this far from the center of the complex. But the celebrations must still be going strong, because I encounter no one. They're all toasting my health in the wedding chamber, unaware that their master is lying on his honeymoon bed unconscious, while their newly crowned mistress is plotting their downfall. I'd love to return to Mr. Dowling's bedroom cum laboratory and immerse myself in the pool of restorative blood and brains. A long soak in that would cure many of my ills. With all the mutants still celebrating the wedding, there's a chance I could steal in, rest up, then slip out again without anyone spotting me. But it's too risky. If one of them spots me in my bloody, bedraggled state, they'll know something is up and raise the alarm. I don't even stop for a few minutes to rest, since the clock is ticking. Instead, I push myself as hard as I can, ignoring the agonized protests of my body as I force it through the pain barrier once again. I come to a room that looks the same as the others. I would have passed through at any other time and thought nothing of it, but I know from Mr. Dowling's stolen memories that there's a hidden door here, so I stop, treat myself to a short pause, then go looking for it. I shuffle to the wall on my right and lift down the upper half of a woman's carcass from where it hangs on a hook. The wall behind her is caked with dried blood and dung. The babies bit off some of my artificial finger bones, but several remain intact. I use them to chip away at the mess. After a while, it starts to fall off in chunks, and the outline of a door is revealed. There's a small, old-fashioned combination lock in the center, the type where you roll the tumblers one at a time until they click into place. I prize the numbers from Mr. Dowling's memory, and they're somehow still clear in my mind. It's like I have perfect recall, I start entering the digits until they read 528-614-592. Then I push down on the slim handle, and the door opens. I stare suspiciously into the gloom of the tunnel on the other side. I still don't know how I wrung so much information out of Mr. Dowling. I hadn't planned to squeeze his secrets from him. I didn't think that I could. Something happened in the bridal suite that I had no control over, and it unnerved me. I don't like the fact that I operated on autopilot like a cold, calculating, experienced spy. But what are my options? I can't go back. Mr. Dowling will slaughter me on sight if I don't get out of here. I might be his beloved, but he can't let me live, knowing what I know. I've got to press ahead as fast as I can. It doesn't matter how I came by this knowledge. I need to cash in on it, and quickly, before the mutants lock down the complex and come hunting for me. I enter the tunnel and push the door closed behind me. There's no way of operating the lock from this side, so I just have to hope that Mr. Dowling's mutants don't spot the disturbance and investigate. Then I press on through the gloom. This area isn't brightly lit, just the occasional light. But that's okay. I know the way. I could find it blindfolded if I had to. The tunnel forks, and I take the left turn. Then a right, another right, a left. These tunnels are roughly carved. Mr. Dowling only used a few of his mutants when creating them, in secret, away from the gaze of his other followers. All of the workers were killed once they'd finished, like the slaves who built the tombs for the pharaohs in ancient Egypt. He didn't want anyone to know about this hidden network. It was created for his personal use only. More twists and turns. I take them without thinking, following the map that was clear as crystal inside Mr. Dowling's brain. He often comes here to check on his deadly prize, standing before it in ecstatic but horrified awe, like a worshipper at the shrine of some old destructive god. There are several entrances and routes. He tests them all out on a regular basis, making sure the doors work, that the paths are clear of cave-ins, that no one has been sniffing around his toxic treasure. It's not a long journey, but I make poor time. I'm incapable of rushing. Still, as slow as I am, I'm dogged, and eventually, I draw to a halt at another locked door. This one is protected by 4 combination locks, each requiring a 12-digit code, and you need a serious stash of dynamite to make an impression on the door or wall. It would take a crack team a lot of time and hassle to break through. Even Ivor Bolton, an angel who can open almost any lock, would have to admit defeat if confronted with these devilish beauties. But I have the inside scoop, the elaborate string of numbers, flashing in my mind's eye as if highlighted on a neon billboard. I start spinning the tumblers, and soon I've set all 48 windows correctly. I grasp the round handle and twist. There's a sighing sound, and the door opens inwards, widening the more I turn the handle, like a giant opening its mouth. I step into a small steel-lined room. There's a single light hanging from the center of the ceiling. It switched on automatically as the door opened. A safe sits in the middle of the room, bolted to the floor. The code for this lock is simpler than any of the others. Mr. Dowling figured that if someone made it this far, the game was up. He set the code out of a sense of irony, more than anything else, aware of the things that Dr. Oystein had said about him over the years. I chuckle weakly as I spin the tumblers to the most diabolical of numbers. 666. The safe opens, and I sink to my knees. I reach in and pull out a clear tube, no more than 20 centimeters long. It's sealed with what looks like a plain rubber cork, but I know the cork is made from a special material and is absolutely airtight. It will never shrink or shake loose. And, although the tube appears to be just glass, again it's been carefully manufactured from a far tougher substance. You could put it on the floor and whack it with a sledgehammer, over and over, without even cracking it. Just to be safe, there's a second clear corked tube nestled within the first, every bit as indestructible as the outer container. And then, snuggled within that, is a vial, maybe 15 centimeters long, filled with a milky white liquid. There's no label on any of the containers, but I don't need one. Schlesinger 10, I croak, holding the tube up to the light, watching the liquid as it splashes around inside the vial. I never wondered what it would be like to hold the lives of every living human in your hands. Now that I'm in that position, I find it absolutely terrifying. I know I can't do any damage to the tubes. I'd have to deliberately uncork the first, slide out the second, uncork that, then slip out and uncork the vial in order to unleash the hounds of havoc. But I still feel sick at the nightmarish thought of the tube slipping through my fingers and somehow smashing open. I guess it's like doing a bungee jump. You know you're safely attached, but try telling that to your natural instincts when you're about to hurl yourself off the side of a cliff. Reverently, knowing I'm not worthy of such a grave responsibility, I lower the tube and look for a place to store it. But there are no pockets in my wedding dress. I could carry it, but I want both hands free. So where? With a grisly snicker, I stick the tube inside my stomach and root around until I find some pliant flesh to wedge it into. I grip my teeth as I work the tube firmly into place, taking no chances, not worrying about the discomfort. When I'm satisfied, I shake myself roughly and jump up and down. The brief burst of exercise almost makes me faint, but the tube doesn't budge. It's secure. I feel like an expectant mother, only instead of carrying a baby, I'm carrying hope for the entire world. If I can get this to Dr. Oystein, the stalemate will be broken, and he can release a sample of Clemens 13, bringing the curtains crashing down on every zombie and mutant on the face of the planet. So, no pressure, I giggle. Then I put all humorous thoughts aside, turn my back on the safe, limp into the corridor, and make my slow, sluggish, excruciating break for freedom. 2. Although most of the access points to the secret tunnels are situated in Mr. Dowling's base, a few open out into the area beyond. He wanted to be able to skirt the main complex in case it ever fell into the hands of his enemies. As crazy as he is, he likes to cover as many angles as possible. I absorbed all sorts of memories from the clown, more than I realized at the time. I knew that I was confirming the location of his vial of Schlesinger 10, but I also tapped into recollections of countless trips that he's made through his underground domain. My mind's full of maps and ways out of here. Assessing that information, I tried to come to a decision. Should I head straight for the surface or stick to the shadows for a while? The nearest exit is through Whitechapel Station. It wouldn't take me long to reach it, even in my current shuffling state. I could climb up through the station and lose myself on the streets. Whitechapel could be my first preference, except I know from Mr. Dowling's memories that the station is always carefully guarded by his forces, along with the one at Aldgate East. The guards might have been pulled from their post to attend the wedding, but I can't count on that. It's unlikely that the mutants would have left themselves completely open to a sneak attack. The alternative is to make use of the various tunnels and link up with the tube line farther west, pop up out of a random station. In its favor, the mutants can't patrol every stretch of tunnel, and they won't know which area of the city to focus their search on once they discover I'm missing. Against, I'll have to spend a lot of time in darkness, meaning I might not see them coming if they happen to chance upon me, and it will be hard, probably impossible, to outrun them if they stumble across my trail before I make it to the streets. I spend a couple of minutes weighing the pros and cons, figuring it's time worth investing. In the end, I decide I'd be safer in the dark. I don't like it down here, but just as it would be hard for me to see any hunters coming, it would be equally difficult for them to spot me going. Having made up my mind, I first head in the direction of Whitechapel. I'm aware that I've left a trail of blood, and I'm hoping to throw off my trackers by continuing east for a spell, to make them think that I'm aiming for the easiest way out. I'm probably being naive. Chances are they have mutants who've been trained to detect the subtlest of scents, but I've nothing to lose by trying. After several minutes, I stop in the glow of a light, and start ripping the remains of the lower lengths of my wedding dress into strips. It was such a lovely dress, and I hate having to wreck it, but it was already in tatters after the attack by the babies. The veil is missing. Huge holes have been torn or bitten out of the material. Its color is now more crimson than white in most places. I ball up some of the strips and press them deep into my flesh, where I'm bleeding worst, plugging the gashes, stemming the flow as best I can. I wince as the material bonds with my flesh, sticking to it like an extra layer. As the balls absorb my blood and swell within me like flowers in bloom, I loop more of the makeshift bandages round my feet and ankles so that they'll hopefully soak up the drops trickling down my legs. I study myself and I'm done. Far from perfect. I'd never have made it as a nurse, but it will have to do. The most important thing is that the vial has remained steady within its nesting place. My movements haven't shaken it loose by even a fraction. That's good to know going forward. Means I don't have to stop to check on it too often. I listen intently for a minute, trying to detect whether the hunters are already on my trail. I hear shuffling sounds close by and stiffen, thinking my number is up. But then, I spot a couple of rats, gnawing on an old bone, and I relax. I suppose I should be grateful that the rodents don't attack me. I'd make a tasty snack for a big enough group of them. If I was human, they'd probably take me down, wounded and bleeding as I am, but zombie blood must not appeal to them. When I'm sure that there are no mutants lurking nearby, waiting to spring upon me the second I turn my back, I take a deep breath. Pointless, since I don't have any lungs, but it's a force of habit. Swing a left and arc back upon myself, heading west, deeper into the twisting network of tunnels. 3. After a while, I move out of the system of secret tunnels into old, disused sewers, the walls crumbling, the floors long dried up, relics of the past, forgotten by all except the mutants who discovered them when scouting around to find the perfect location for their base. Judging by the complete silence, I think even the rats and insects of London don't know about these ancient arteries. It's pitch black here, and I have to feel my way along. There's no way up to the streets from these abandoned sewers, at least none that Mr. Dowling is aware of. But they link with the tube lines in several places, offering me a choice of exits when I've advanced farther. I think a normal living person would be afraid if they found themselves in my position. The isolated sewers have a ghostly feel to them, and it's easy to imagine the spirits of the past drifting around me as I stumble ahead, or monsters, like the Minotaur, roaming freely, looking for victims. But, seeing as how I'm an undead monster myself, I have nothing to fear. In fact, despite my earlier misgivings, I'm starting to feel at home. In the ragged remains of my torn, blood-stained white dress, with all my injuries and disfigurements, I could easily pass for an otherworldly specter. If I didn't have priceless cargo to deliver, this would be a good place to rest up, wait for my senses to dissolve, then crash around in for the next few thousand years. I couldn't do any harm down here, lost to the world of the conscious, out of sight and out of mind. As I'm edging forward blindly, thinking about maybe coming back here if I manage to complete my mission, I hear noises from far off. At least I think they're far away. But it's hard to be certain in this subterranean realm, where the tunnels do strange things to sounds. Sometimes an echo carries for hundreds of meters, through a series of corridors, strong and vibrant. Other times, a loud bang can be smothered by the hungry walls before it leaves a room. I can't tell for sure whether the noises came from a near or distant source, but I know that they're voices, angry voices. I pause and listen cautiously, but the voices fade away a few seconds later, plunging me back into silence. I could wait for the sounds to come again, but that would be suicidal. I know what the voices mean. The alarm has been raised. The mutants are coming after me. The chase is on. 4. I'd like to pick up the pace, I'm conscious all the time of the precious vial nestled inside me, and the need to get it to Dr. Oystein as quickly as I can. But I can't go any faster. I'm too injured, too exhausted. Besides, I'm better off taking my time. Even if I was at my physical peak, I probably wouldn't risk proceeding at more than a crawl. In the darkness, with all manner of unseen obstacles to contend with, I'd be falling over with every few rush steps. Slowly does it, girl. Voices carry to me every so often. Shouts, grunts, hisses. But there are never faces to go with the voices. The mutants don't cut across my trail, and I continue to huff and puff along in the dark. Until suddenly, I spot the light of a flashlight coming towards me. By the glow, I see that I'm in a long tunnel, one of the old, decrepit sections of the sewers. The light is coming from a smaller, more recently constructed tunnel, ahead and to my left. I freeze and look for a hiding place, but there are no niches that I can duck into, no piles of debris to hide behind. Fear lends me an unexpected burst of energy, and I hurry to the opening of the side tunnel. As the person holding the flashlight draws close, I press myself against the wall, trying to disappear into the shadows, hoping I won't be noticed if the mutant... It has to be one of Mr. Dowling's team. It couldn't possibly be anyone else. Focuses their attention dead ahead, where the beam is brightest. Two mutants step out into my stretch of tunnel. The one holding the flashlight is a tall guy, his face covered in the scabs and sores common to his kind. He sweeps the beam left, then right. I'm almost directly behind him. For once, I'm delighted that I don't have lungs. It means I don't have to hold my breath. This is ridiculous, the shorter mutant snorts. We're never going to find her. It's like, if you say, looking for a needle in a haystack again, Glenn, I'll throttle you, the mutant with the flashlight snaps. Well, it is, the guy named Glenn complains. Yeah, his partner sighs. But Mr. Dowling will know if we simply go through the motions. Kinzo told us to keep searching until we're recalled. I'm not going to ignore a direct order, not from that guy. Me neither, Glenn says. But I think we'd be better off if the lot of us gathered round County Hall and blocked every approach. She's bound to head there, isn't she? It would make more sense than wasting our time down here. Who made you the genius on the team? The mutant with the flashlight laughs. He starts down the tunnel in the direction that I've come from. Don't worry. I'm sure Mr. Dowling or Kinslow has thought of that too. We'll be packed off there if we don't find her. But she can't have made it out of the tunnels yet, so we might as well cast around for her while she's on our turf, just in case. The dejected Glenn follows after his friend, and my fingers clench into triumphant fists. I suppose, Glenn concedes, but I was enjoying myself at the party. We could have sunk a few more beers before we... The mutant's foot catches on something, and he goes down with a yelp. His partner laughs, and turns to help him up. The beam of his flashlight swings round, and I'm caught. The taller mutant gapes at me. His jaw actually drops. Don't just stand there, Glenn huffs. Help me! Then he notes the other guy's expression, and starts to turn. I hurl myself forward. I jump on the sprawled Glenn's back and use him as a springboard, targeting the flashlight. I'm a physical wreck. In a fair fight, they take me without breaking into a sweat. But if I can remove the light from the equation, anything could happen in the dark. The mutant with the flashlight is lugging a crowbar in his other hand. He swings it at me as I jump, but he's startled, clumsy. Doesn't take the fraction of a second that he needs to judge his blow and bring the bar slamming down on my head. It only grazes my shoulder while I swipe the flashlight away. The flashlight goes flying, bounces a few times across the floor, but doesn't shatter. The beam is pointing away from us, so we're in gloom, but not total darkness. I jab the fingers of my right hand at the mutant's head, planning to smash through his skull and destroy his brain. But in the heat of the moment, I forget that some of my finger bones were mutilated by the babies. I scratch the mutant, but nothing worse than that. He drives an elbow into my ribs, or rather, into the space where my ribs should be. Not connecting as he expected to, he's caught off balance. I grab him by the neck and force him down, using his awkward momentum against him. Falling on top of the mutant, I extend a finger that still boasts a bone and try to poke it through one of his eyes. Before I can, Glenn lurches at me and knocks me off his colleague. "I've got to, Aussie!" he roars, rolling onto his back and holding me pinned on top of him. "Finish her off!" Aussie scrambles for his crowbar. I do my best to tear free of Glenn, but he has a firm grip on me and is shielding himself skillfully. "Hold her still," Aussie snarls, taking careful aim with the crowbar. "You bloody try it if you think it's that easy," Glenn shouts, ever the whiner. Aussie bashes my shoulders with the crowbar a few times. I yell with pain and lash out with a kick. He dances backwards, chuckling grimly. "Stop playing with her," Glenn screams. "I'm not playing," Aussie says, cocky now that he's sized me up and seen how feeble I am. "I just don't want to kill her if I don't have to." "They said that we could," Glenn squeals. He can't see me as well as Aussie can. He doesn't know that the fight was knocked out of me long before this pair of jokers hit the scene. "Yeah," Aussie drawls, "but think how pleased Mr. Dowling will be if we bring her back to him in one piece." "We're not bloody heroes," Glenn protests, and despite my dire situation, I find myself admiring his honesty. "Kill her while you can, you fool, before she turns the tables on us." "She won't be turning anything," Aussie says, using the tip of the crowbar to poke my chin up so that my head tilts back. His smile fades and his eyes go hard. "But you're right, we're not heroes. Kinslow said that the vial was more important than the girl. Let's make sure she has it. If she has, I'll crack her skull open. As long as we return with the booty, we'll enjoy a hero's welcome." Aussie retrieves the flashlight while I struggle ineffectively. He shines the light on me, my hands first, then the area around me. "Where is it?" he asks. "Get stuffed," I growl, lashing at Glenn's shins with my heels. He winces, but I can't do any real damage because of the strips of cloth wrapped round my feet. "I don't want to torture you if I don't have to," Aussie says. "We're not like that, me and Glenn." "Yeah," Glenn says earnestly. "We'd rather kill you cleanly." Aussie nods. "Tell us where the vial is, and I'll make it quick. You have my word." "You can stick your word up your arse, along with my fist and my half the arm behind it," I jeer. Aussie doesn't take kindly to that. His eyes narrow, and he raises the bar menacingly. Then he scowls and pokes the tip into the gap where my stomach wall should be. He starts jerking it around, trying to hurt me and force me to tell them about the vial. But he's an amateur. Torture's clearly not his thing. He was telling the truth about that. But what Aussie and Glenn lack in skill and temperament, they make up for with luck. It was the luck of the devil that they stumbled across me in the first place, and now that lucky streak strikes again as Aussie's crowbar bangs into the vial, tucked away deep inside me, and makes a dull clanging noise. Aussie pauses. "No way," he mutters. Then he spies my appalled expression and hoots. "Thanks a lot, Mrs. Dowling. You've made my day." "Where is it?" Glenn pants, as Aussie bends to root through the remains of my guts. "Is it the vial?" "Yeah," Aussie says. "Has to be." "Well, don't go searching for it now, you dope," Glenn yells at him. "Finish her off first. Otherwise, she'll wriggle free while you're digging around. Bite through your brain and we'll be up the creek without a paddle." Aussie thinks about that and sniffs. "You're right," he says, standing and adjusting his grip on the crowbar. He closes one eye and lines up his shot. "Turn your head away, Glenn. There's gonna be blood, bone, and all sorts of muck flying your way in a second. Just don't miss her and hit me by mistake," Glenn says, shifting about beneath me, trying to hide his face between my shoulder blades. "If you don't quit griping, it won't be a mistake," Aussie says sourly, then draws back his crowbar and prepares to strike. I kick at him, hoping to catch him between the thighs, but he's alert to the threat and has stood at an angle to protect himself. as I stare hopelessly at the raised bar, bitterly waiting for the end, cursing this sickening twist of fate. There's a flash of movement, and something small hurls itself at Ossie. His face is obscured by a shimmering ball of white and red. He falls away with a yell, the crowbar and flashlight dropping from his fingers, hammering at whatever has attached itself to his head. "Ossie!" Ven screeches. "What's going on?" Muffled screams are Ossie's only response. He thrashes around, blood spraying from his shredded cheeks, tiny hands ripping away at his flesh, razor-sharp teeth cutting in deeper. Glenn curses and pushes me aside. He dives for the crowbar, picks it up and strikes at the creature attacking his partner. Unfortunately for Glenn and Ossie, it smoothly pushes itself clear as the bar swings in. Instead of clobbering his assailant, the bar smashes into the side of Ossie's head, and he falls to the floor, a silent heap. "Oh no," Glenn moans. "Sorry, Ossie, I didn't mean to." Before Glenn can complete his apology, he's attacked. His face becomes the center of a ball of moving white, glints of red among the paleness. He screams and begs for mercy, but he's wasting his breath. I've identified his foe, and I know that mercy isn't in its nature. Glenn's throat is soon ripped open, and he's dead long before his attacker finishes with him and leaps aside, leaving him to collapse in a heap beside his unconscious friend. The killer returns to Ossie and chews through his throat, then sticks a small hand up his neck and inside his head, yanking out bits of brain, making sure he doesn't spring any surprises or send word of what happened back to base. It does the same thing with Glenn, taking no chances. Then it turns to face me and glides closer, a tiny figure, dressed in a white gown, the material soaked with blood, red eyes, fangs, a hole in its thin skull, which is a smaller mirror image of the hole in my chest. "Hello, Mummy," Holy Moly says, and smiles. 5. The baby cuddles up to me and hugs my left arm. Then it reaches up and tenderly strokes my cheek. It leaves a wet red smear behind. "I stopped the bad men hurting you, Mummy." "Yes," I sob, clutching Holy Moly tight. "Thank you." "Don't be sad, Mummy. You're safe now. I'll look after you." I'm not used to having one of the babies speak to me directly, as an individual. Normally it's always we, not I. "Are you alone?" I ask. "No," the baby cackles. "Silly Mummy, I'm with you." I smile. "I meant, are any of the other babies with you?" "Oh, no. I came by myself. We were worried about you, Mummy." I squeeze Holy Moly tighter, then release the sweet but deadly infant and wipe some blood from its forehead and chin. "You'll need to wash when you get back. You're dirty."
"It's only blood, Mummy," the baby says, then sucks a drop from its fingertip. "Yummy. But not as yummy as yummy Mummy."
"You little charmer," I murmur, pushing myself to my feet. I gaze at the corpses and wince. Glenn and Ossie had been all set to kill me, but they weren't the most ruthless villains I've come across. I wish we could have spared them.
"How did you find me?" I ask Holy Moly. "Did I leave a trail?"
"No," the baby says. "We can always find Mummy." It taps the side of its head. The bloody telepathic link that our man told me about. The babies have always been able to find me, shadowing me for much of my childhood, keeping tabs on me from a distance. Does that mean that Mr. Dowling can follow me too, since we now share a link like the one I have with the babies?
"No, Mummy," Holy Moly says, reading my troubled thoughts. "That's not the same as our link. Daddy can't search for you that way."
"That's a relief," I mutter. "Though I don't suppose it makes a difference. He'll simply tag along after the others when they come looking for me."
"They won't do that," the baby says. "I'm the only one who's coming to help Mummy. Only me. Only Holy Moly."
It's the first time I've heard the baby use the name I gave it. I ruffle the sinister child's hair, feeling bizarrely proud, then sigh. The rest of them will search for me when Daddy tells them to.
I note glumly. The baby shakes his head. He did ask them. He roared at us. Holy moly looks rueful. Naughty daddy. He shouted. Scared his little babies. Mummies and daddies should be nice all the time. Not in this world, I say darkly, remembering my own brute of a father. So you're telling me you guys refuse to help the clown find me? Holy moly nods firmly. Daddy wanted to kill Mummy. We could see it in his head. We won't help him do that. The same way we wouldn't let you kill him. We love our yummy Mummy. I grin savagely, imagining how furious Mr. Dowling must have been when his beloved creations rejected his orders, and he wouldn't have been able to reason with or threaten them. The babies are a law unto themselves, exactly the way he made them. Daddy sent his other friends after Mummy instead, Holy Moly continues. We knew they'd kill Mummy if they caught her. Some of us said it would serve her right for hurting Daddy. But we didn't mean it. We all love you, Mummy. Did the other babies send you to help me? I ask. No, Holy Moly says. I came because I wanted to. I often go off by myself. That's how the bad people caught me and did this. The baby points to the hole in its head, reminding me of the time when my friend Timothy first introduced me to his incredible find. He discovered the baby on a street, speared through its skull, immobile and defenseless. We never did find out who attacked it. I could ask now, but this isn't the time for such questions. I need to get back to the city, I tell Holy Moly. Can you help me? Easy, the baby says confidently. It could be dangerous, I warn. If Daddy's forces spot us, they might punish you for helping me. They won't find us, Holy Moly says. I can see in the dark better than they can. I can go places they don't know about. The baby squeezes my hand. I'll look after you, Mummy. I'll keep you safe. I am a good baby, I am. I recall the movie My Fair Lady, which my mum loved and often made me watch with her. Thinking about the woman in that, her catchphrase was, I'm a good girl, I am. I laugh hysterically. It's dangerous, making this much noise, but I can't help myself. Finally, my laughter dies away and I regain control. Okay, where now? This way, Holy Moly says, starting back the way I was coming from when Ossie and Glenn found me. You're sure? Yes. Stick with Holy Moly. I know where I'm going. I wonder for a worried moment if the baby might be planning to trick me and lead me back to Mr. Dowling's base, to hand me over to its dastardly daddy. But it would have been easier to let the mutants kill me if that was the case, or just help them bind me and drag me along. Wait a sec. I stop my mini guide, bending to pick up the flashlight. The tube inside me shifts around a bit when I do that. It must have been knocked loose in the fighting. So I take the time to nudge it firmly back into place. When my cargo is secure, I shine the flashlight around to check that I'm not leaving any bloody prints, then turn it off. While it might come in handy later, for the time being we'll be safer in the darkness. But then, I see that we're not completely in the dark. Holy Moly's eyes are still glowing crimson. Can you make your eyes stop doing that? I ask. Doing what? The baby replies. Glowing. Other people might see. The baby grins, showing its fangs. Clever Mummy, it coos, letting the red light dim and then vanish, plunging us back into fathomless black. Yeah, I'm a regular Einstein, me, I croak. Who is Einstein, Mummy? Holy Moly asks. I'll tell you as we walk, I whisper, holding the baby's hand tightly so as not to get lost. It will help pass the time. And you can tell me about, I think for a moment, then add jokingly, killing, in return. Oh, good, the baby says, taking my joke seriously, and I can sense its innocent yet chilling grin, even though I can't see its face. I know lots about that. 6. Holy Moly is as good as its word. We slip through the tunnels like a pair of ghosts. Occasionally we hear echoes of mutants in the distance, but we don't encounter any of them as we wind our way across the city, and eventually all of the noises dwindle away completely. Talking is an effort, so I don't tell the baby as many tales as I meant to, and I definitely don't push it to tell me any horrible stories about killing, even though it's indicated that it would be only too keen to share them with me. Holy moly doesn't mind. It's happy to march along in silence, delighted to be of service to its mummy. Sheer stubbornness keeps me going. I'm wrecked. I should lie down and rest for hours, maybe days. But I'm not convinced I'd find the strength to rise again if I stopped, so I force myself on. I think of my reception at County Hall when I'm feeling especially weary. I try to imagine what it will be like, Dr. Oystein embracing me, distraught when he sees my wounds, stunned and delighted when I reveal the vial of Schlesinger 10. That moment will mark the beginning of our end. Once the doc has secured the vial, he'll uncork his sample of Clemens 13, and the deadly fumes will start working their way through the air. He expects the virus to spread across the globe within a couple of weeks, killing every zombie that it infects. In a fortnight's time, this world will belong to the living again. I wonder if they'll mark our passing when we're gone, if there'll be plaques or statues to commemorate my name, Dr. Oystein's, the rest of the angels, or will they try to forget about this squalid, terrible time? Maybe they'll wipe all trace of us from the history books, or claim the victory as their own. They might not want their children and grandchildren to grow up feeling indebted to a raggedy mob of the undead. I'm not bothered either way. Like the doc, I'm not in this for the glory. I just want to do what I can to help, then check out of this hurtful world. True death will be a relief after this wretched in-between state. But linking up with Dr. Oystein again, handing over the vial, hearing the angels cheer my name. Yeah, that will be nice. All modesty aside, I can't wait for my moment in the spotlight. I'll be getting the stamp of approval from the only people I really feel close to. The rest of the world can keep its statues and busts. If Dr. Oystein says he's proud of me, and the angels salute me, I can die a happy girl. Happy, mummy, Holy Moly mumbles, reading my thoughts. Very happy. I smile in the darkness. Are you happy too? I'm happy if mummy's happy, the baby says. That simple statement makes my heart ache, or the memory of it anyway. I wish we could spare the babies. It's not fair that they have to perish along with the rest of us. You deserve better than this, I tell Holy Moly, and I mean it. They might be savage little killing machines, but that's not their fault. They're capable of love, too. Innocent in many ways. They could have been turned to the cause of good if they'd had Dr. Oystein as a father figure instead of the psychotic clown. As things stand, they don't understand the difference between good and evil. Nobody's ever taught them. I trudge along, my spirit sinking, thinking of all that must be sacrificed once my mission is complete. But the future of the living has to come before all other concerns. This was their planet first, and we have to hand it back. That's been my priority since I returned to consciousness, even before I stumbled upon Dr. Oystein and his angels in County Hall. I was trying to help those who had survived. It's not that I'm a natural do-gooder. To be perfectly honest, I'm no more heroic than Ossie and Glenn were. But sometimes you get thrown in at the deep end, and you spot someone more needy and vulnerable than yourself. And you realize that if you don't put their needs first and risk your life to save theirs, then you'll eke out the rest of your days as a guilt-ridden monster. And who wants to carry on living with that sort of a millstone hanging around their neck? As my thoughts turn more maudlin, Holy Moly helps me squeeze through a hole, and we strike the tracks of a tube line. The going is easier here. There's even the occasional light to see by. I worry that we might run into mutants. I thought Mr. Dowling would have dispatched patrols in both directions along the track, figuring I'd have to connect with it at some point, but there's no sign of them. We pass through Mansion House Station, dotted with zombies who pay us little heed. Strange to think they'll all be stiff, harmless corpses within a few weeks, decomposing sacks of flesh and bone. Will humans come through here again one day, clean the cadavers away, and restore the train service? Or will they shut these places down and leave them as mausoleums, bearers of the dark, grisly secrets of the past. I hobble along stubbornly without pause, through the stations at Blackfriars and Temple, only stopping when I come to Embankment. This is where I'll leave the underworld behind, taking the station exit, like commuters did in the old days. You can leave me here if you like, I tell Holy Moly. The baby shakes its head. Not until we get to the city. I promise to take you to the city, Mummy. You'd have made a great bodyguard, I chuckle, then lift Holy Moly up onto the platform. I didn't really need to do that. The baby can look after itself, but I wanted to feel useful. I groan and wheeze, trying to pull myself up too. Holy Moly could help, maybe find a rope or some bags that I could use as steps, but it can see that I want to do this by myself. So it stands there quietly, leaving me to my own devices. There are lots of zombies filling the platform, which means it must be daytime, up in the world above. The living dead hordes study me with disinterest, not caring where I've come from or why I'm dressed so strangely. They have no interest in anyone that they can't eat. Finally, I clear the tracks and haul myself to my feet. I feel like I've climbed a mountain. I clasp my hands over my head and cheer jokingly at the zombies on the platform. But then I spot a figure standing close by the spot where I crawled up, and I stop in mild amazement. It's a woman. She's dressed in white robes, and her hair is white too. I've seen her before in a station like this, when her robes and hair were a lot cleaner than they are now, but that was at Liverpool Street Station. She was alive when she entered the place, but she never came out. I turned her into a zombie, at her request, to prevent her brain from being eaten when we were cornered by a pack of revivids. Sister Claire? I wheeze with disbelief. The former leader of the Order of the Schnocks doesn't respond. She's staring off into space, like most of the zombies on the platform. How did you get here? I groan, shuffling across to stand in front of her, wanting her to recognize me and respond. The zombie says nothing. She doesn't even look at me. I study the once screwy Sister Claire. She looks much the same as I remember. The months have been good to her. Dirtier than when she was alive. Her face stained with dried blood from where she's eaten. Robes filthy and ripped in several places. But otherwise, there's not much difference. Poor cow, I whisper, reaching up to touch her cheek. She doesn't flinch. You hoped you'd revitalize, but that was never an option. I didn't know it then, but I suppose it wouldn't have mattered if I had. You were trapped. There was nothing else we could have done. It was join them or become their lunch. Sister Claire frowns and turns her gaze on me. She's not used to talking zombies. She checks the hole where my heart should be, making sure I'm really dead, then looks ahead again, dismissing me without thought. I wish I could do something for her, but she seems to be in good shape. Judging by the stains around her mouth, she ate not that long ago. There isn't really any way for me to improve her sad lot. Come on, I tell Holy Moly, taking its hand. We're on my turf now. Let me be the guide for a while. Is your friend coming with us, Mummy? The baby asks. That crazy witch is no friend of mine, I snort. But then I pause and glance back one last time at the statue-like Sister Claire. There's no reason why I should care about the mad zealot, after she brought her grisly end down on herself, leading a group of other people to their death while she was at it. But for some strange reason, I feel sorry for her. You'll be properly dead soon, I murmur, insides clenching round the buried vial. I hope you find peace. Whether it's in heaven or with your aliens, think of me every so often if you do. Then, having wasted enough time on the undead woman, I work my way up through the station, squeezing by the zombies who pack the platform and tunnels. They're even crowding the escalators, sitting or standing on the steps, gazing blankly off into the distance like Sister Claire was. I wish the escalators were working, what I wouldn't give for a smooth ride up out of the depths, but they're as lifeless as the people stacked along them. I limp onwards and upwards. Holy Moly ducks in and out between my legs as I walk, treating this as a game. I'm not looking any farther ahead than the next step, not wanting to focus on how far I have to go, knowing I'd lose heart if I stopped to check. What I can't see can't freak me out. Eventually, I make it to the top, and I'm more relieved than I should be. I was beginning to think that I truly died, that this was hell, an endless series of steps that I'd have to spend all of eternity climbing. That was easy, wasn't it? I mutter. Yes, Holy Moly says, missing the sarcasm. The ticket barriers are open, so at least I don't have that hassle to deal with. We push through and out of the riverbank exit, into sunlight. The light hurts my eyes, but not as much as I thought it would, and it starts to get dimmer after a few seconds, cancelling out the headache that I normally get when traveling by day. The dimness confuses me, until I recall the special contact lenses that Mr. Dowling stuck in when he rebuilt my ruined body. They must feature an automatic tinting system. I'm still not comfortable in the sunlight, but I can deal with it and see much more clearly than I could before. Thanks, hubby, I whisper and spread my arms wide, feeling like Lazarus reborn. I'm sure I'm wearing a goofy smile, but I don't care. This is glorious, after the darkness of that underworld realm. Even the itching isn't as bad as it used to be, probably because of all the replacement flesh that the clown grafted onto me. Shall I leave you here, Mummy? Holy Moly asks. That surprises me. The baby seems almost eager to be rid of me, but then I recall that I asked it to lead me safely to the city. Now that we're here, it clearly thinks that its job is done. It's not looking to abandon me. It just assumes that I have no more need of it and want to be by myself. The babies are nothing if not literal. Stick with me for a few more minutes, I tell it, heading under a bridge to the right of the station. I want to show you where I live. It's a lovely sight. Let me share it with you. Your reward for helping me out. Silly Mummy, Holy Moly beams. I don't need a reward. I love you, Mummy. But the baby comes with me anyway, to humor me. I've a feeling it would go anywhere I asked it to go. A railway line crosses the river here. There are footbridges attached to both sides. I limp across to the one that faces Westminster. Steps lead up to the bridge, but there's also an elevator. I say a little prayer that it's working, and what do you know? The guards are smiling on me for once. Going up! I laugh as we ascend. Holy Moly looks the teeniest bit scared. I don't think the baby has been in an elevator before. I tickle the little one's belly to distract it, and it laughs with utter delight. The elevator stops, and we shuffle out. I pick up Holy Moly and stagger to the rails, to point towards the Houses of Parliament, then across the river to the gleaming London Eye, County Hall, lying just behind it. There, I tell Holy Moly, that's where Mummy and her friends live. Isn't it the most wonderful place you've ever... My words tail off. It's a sunny day in London. The rays pick out the eye and the building to its rear. The pair of landmarks shine majestically, as if the daylight was created to highlight their glory. But, with the help of my contact lenses, I can see other things just as clearly. Mutants, zombies, and scores of babies. Each of the infants an exact replica of Holy Moly, only without a hole in its head. Mr. Dowling's troops, gathered in their grisly might, have formed a ring around County Hall, and are in the process of overrunning the complex. As I watch with stunned horror, they dash in and out of the entrances, smashing windows, killing anyone they find. The clown and his lethal posse have launched an attack on County Hall, the home of Dr. Oystein and his angels. And, by the look of things, the battle has already been decided. The good guys have lost. The bad guys have won. I think of the vial inside my stomach. I stare at the sickening scenes across the river. I lower my head and make a weak, keening noise, not cursing this twist of fate, not mourning those I've probably lost, just thinking numbly. Who the hell can I turn to now? 7. Several corpses have been heaped in the middle of Jubilee Gardens, a small park between the bridge and County Hall. Furniture has been stacked nearby, and many mutants are adding to the pile, racing in and out of the building with tables, chairs, and bedding, which they deposit on the growing mound. As other mutants soak the pyre with gasoline, one lights a torch, then steps forward and shouts a warning. The rest of them scatter, and the torch is hurled onto the primed furniture. A bonfire explodes into life. The mutants cheer and applaud. Then they start tossing the bodies of my slain comrades onto the flames.
Toasty,
Holy Moly murmurs approvingly, but I don't react, reminding myself that the baby's been brought up to see nothing amiss in atrocities like this. Despite my improved vision, I can't see from here if the angels being fed to the fire were some of my roommates, Shane, Arshtat, Carl, or others I felt close to, and I don't want to know. Better the corpses remain faceless. That way I don't have to mourn them. I spot an angel climbing onto the roof in an attempt to get away. It looks like a girl, but I can't be sure. She stumbles off in the direction of St. Thomas's Hospital, but doesn't get far. Babies follow and launch themselves in a deadly swarm at the helpless revitalized, dragging her down and ripping into her. I spy another angel, a boy, in a pod on the London Eye. He must have been on watch when the attack commenced, so it can't have been more than a half an hour ago, which is roughly the time it takes for a pod to complete a revolution. The angel is gazing down on a group of mutants. They're packing all sorts of weapons and howling gleefully, waving at the trapped boy, making crude gestures. Some begin to climb up to the pod, impatient, eager to strike the first blow. As mutants scrabble across the top of the pod and try to smash through the glass, the angel makes a crude gesture of his own, then drives the bones sticking out of his fingers through his skull. The mutant screeches spitefully, but he ignores them and digs around inside his head. Moments later, he drops to the floor of the pod, set free from the torment that would otherwise have awaited him. I hate being a helpless observer. I want to dash across the bridge, cut through Jubilee Gardens, fight and die with those who have become my family over the last few months. But I don't have the energy for a stylish finale. If I start limping across this walkway, I'll be spotted long before I reach the other side. Mutants will flood the bridge and either kill me or haul me back for Mr. Dowling to deal with. So I hold my ground and watch numbly as County Hall falls to its foes. I'm surprised they were able to take it so easily. I thought the angels would have offered more resistance. Master Zhang trained us to be clinical fighting machines. We should have been able to at least trouble the mutants and babies. But it looks like they took this place as swiftly and casually as they took Battersea Power Station. I wonder if Dr. Oystein has been killed. There aren't that many dead angels outside the building, so most must be lining the corridors inside. Dr. Oystein's corpse almost surely lies among one of the groups, unless he happened to be at his secret lab when Mr. Dowling surged up out of the depths. If the doc was here when the invasion began, how did he react? Seeing that the end was upon him, did he uncork his vial of Clemens 13, figuring Mr. Dowling wouldn't have attacked unless he'd been robbed of his sample of Schlesinger 10? Maybe ultimate victory is already ours, despite the casualties and the loss of our base. Perhaps this is merely Mr. Dowling's compensation prize, annihilation of his most hated enemy, before he falls foul of the unleashed virus and drops dead in a matter of days. Then again, Dr. Oystein never told us where his vial of Clemens 13 was stored. I'm sure he has some, in his hidden laboratory, but did he keep another vial on him, or tucked away in a safe nook in County Hall? I'm guessing he did, in order to be ready for a surprise attack like this, but I can't be certain. Mr. Dowling can't have been certain either. That's why he never struck the first blow. But now, robbed of his ultimate deterrent, he's had to gamble. I left him with no other choice. Understanding the clown as intimately as I do, I knew that his first task would be to find me and retrieve his vial of Schlesinger 10 to re-establish the status quo. He likes things the way they've been since the world fell. The war between the living and the undead. the chaos and disorder. But I didn't consider what he'd do when his mutants failed to track me down. He must have decided to strike immediately before I returned to County Hall. He probably figured that he was definitely dead if he waited. At least this way he had a chance. I should have anticipated this. If I'd been thinking clearly, I would have acted more swiftly, made for the surface as soon as I could, maybe sent Holy Moly on ahead of me to warn Dr. Oystein and tell him to clear out. I thought I had time to play with. I was wrong. "It's a bloody mess," I sob, turning away from the carnage, sick of it all, not wanting to torture myself any further.
"Mummy?"
Holy Moly asks, surprised by my sadness. The baby doesn't understand why I'm miserable. The slaughter across the river is nothing more than a jolly piece of theater, as far as it's concerned, par for the course when their father is abroad.
"What's wrong, Mummy? Don't cry. We don't like it when you cry. We love you, Mummy."
"I'm okay," I lie, just sad because my friends are dead.
"Everything dies, Mummy," Holy Moly says.
"Is that supposed to comfort me?" I snap. Holy Moly nods sweetly.
"Yes,"
I suppress a grimace. "I know you mean well, but I'd rather be by myself right now. Will you leave me, like you were going to a while ago?"
"If that's what you want," Holy Moly says uncertainly, worried about me now.
"It is," I say firmly. "You guided me to safety. You're a good boy, or girl, or whatever the hell you are. I'll be fine on my own."
"Okay, Mummy,"
Holy Moly says, and sets off across the bridge, moving with its characteristic eerie smoothness and speed.
"Wait,"
I call the baby back.
"Where are you going?"
"There," Holy Moly says, pointing at County Hall.
"I want to be with the others. They look like they're having fun."
"I'm sure they are," I say bitterly, finding it hard not to hate the baby right now. "But will you do me a favor?"
"Of course,"
it squeals, excited to be of service. "Will you go the other way?" I ask. "Back underground, to wait for the rest of them in Daddy's den?" Holy Moly stares at me, its pale forehead wrinkling.
"But I'll miss the fighting, Mummy."
"That's not a bad thing," I tell it. "I don't want you to fight."
"Why not?"
I pause, wondering how to explain the difference between good and evil. In the end, I decide it's a hopeless task, that I'd only confuse the poor thing if I began lecturing it. "I'm worried you might get hurt," I say instead. The baby giggles.
"Silly Mummy."
"Silly as they come," I smile stiffly. "But please, do this for me. I'll be happy if I know you're safe."
"Okay, Mummy,"
Holy Moly sighs, and sets off in the other direction, back the way we came. The baby stops at the elevator door, and stares solemnly at the button, turns and looks at me.
"Can I use the stairs instead of the small room? I didn't like the small room, Mummy."
I nod. "The stairs will be fine."
"Thank you, Mummy,"
Holy Moly says, trotting to the top step.
"Wait!"
I stop the baby again. It looks back questioningly.
"I'm tired, and I don't want to think about the future, but I must. I know that Dr. Oystein would want me to fight on, even when all else seems lost.
There's not much I can do by myself to thwart the forces of wickedness and madness, but maybe I can throw a wrench in the works, or at least cause them a few sleepless nights."
"Come here,"
I call to Holy Moly, crouching down and leaning back against the bars that support the railing that runs across the bridge. "I want to make my last will and testament, and I'd like you to be my executor."
"I don't understand, Mummy,"
Holy Moly says. "I know," I laugh softly, "but it won't take me long to explain." 8. I rest on the bridge after Holy Moly has slipped away, listening to the roars, screams, and crackle of flames in the near distance. The mutants have started fires inside County Hall, hell-bent on burning the place to the ground. I don't think they stand a hope of doing that, but they can certainly gut a lot of it if they carry on as they've begun. As I'm gathering myself for my final push, I think about Dr. Oystein and the angels, Kiara and Riley, Master Zhang. Are any of them alive? Did some of them make it out before the net closed? If so, how many will survive the next few challenging weeks,
robbed of their base and support. I could easily stay where I am and brood, but since I don't want to be discovered by a stray mutant or baby, I crawl to the elevator. In my state, the stairs would be too much of a challenge, and return to ground level. I limp along beside the river, heading east simply because that's the most direct route out of here. I stick close to the buildings on my left, hugging the shadows, making sure no one on the south bank can spot me. I want to feel worse than I do, have a nervous breakdown, beat the pavement with my fists, howl at the sky, and demand justice from God. But I've endured so many terrible things in recent times that I can't work up to a hysterical high. I've lost my family and everyone I cared about, been tortured by one homicidal maniac, and married to another. Ever since I was turned into a zombie, it seems that all the world has wanted to do is pummel me, cast me aside and leave me to wander on my own through the urban wilderness. In the past, I had hoped to keep me going, the hope that I might be able to help the living, that there was a place for me in this savage new society, that I could be of worth. That hope has been cut away from me. This was one blow too many. It's not the physical pain that has left me feeling hollow inside, or the loss of my friends, or the fact that I'm all on my own. No, the reason I feel like I'm all washed up is that this has happened to me over and over again. The forces of destiny, or luck, are not on my side. Everything in nature seems to be lined up against me. Why push on and fight for a world that clearly doesn't want me, that has punished me at every well-meaning turn? I'm not dumb. I get the message. I tried to play the part of a hero, even though it wasn't in my genes, but some higher power has decided I'm not fit for that role. It wants the glory to go to someone else. I understand. In truth, that's the way it should be. A hero should be someone proud and noble, not a loud-mouthed girl who was too afraid to stand up to a racist, who threw an innocent boy to a pack of zombies because she didn't have the guts to disobey her bullying father. Heh. It always comes back to Tyler Bayer. I suppose it always should. That's when I cast my humanity aside. Everything since then has been an attempt to make up for that foul deed, to redeem myself. But some creeps aren't worthy of redemption. Time for me to find a hole where I can curl up and die. Except I won't truly die, will I? I can lie there, starve and wait for my senses to crumble. But that's not the same thing. I'll carry on as a mindless zombie in that case, and maybe kill again one day. I want out. I need to get out. If I could rely on the mutants and babies to kill me, I'd throw myself into the battle at County Hall and perish with my friends and allies. But there's a good chance that they'd take me captive and deliver me to their master instead, and who knows where things would go from there. No, if I want this job done properly, I have to do it myself. I'll find a drill or a chainsaw and bore into my skull. Hell, even a good sharp knife will suffice. Having made up my mind, all that remains is to choose my spot. Most people aren't that fortunate when it's their time to pass on from this realm. They simply drop wherever fate decrees. But whether I deserve it or not, I have a choice. I can do it somewhere random, or I can pick a place that means something to me. I think about it as I shuffle along. Both options have their appeal. A random location would allow me to do it sooner rather than later. And I think it would be fitting if I died in a lonely, unmarked place. After all, isn't that where all failures should wind up? But at the same time, if there is a higher power, one that's been stacking the deck of cards against me, I wouldn't mind sticking a couple fingers up at it before I check out. Be Smith. Rebel to the end. I decide on my old flat in the East End. I've had several bases since then, but that's the spot I always think of as home. I didn't realize it at the time, but that's where I was at my happiest. I had plenty of lousy experiences there too, when Dad terrorized Mom and me, and that's where I was loved and bullied, where I was safe most of the time, where I was free to grow and learn and live under the thumb of an outright racist. Yeah, the flat will be a good finishing point, a neat way to draw a line under my existence, pick up a sharp tool along the way, drag myself up the stairs, crawl into my old room, lie on my bed, stare at the ceiling, go to work on my head, churn up my brain, and let it all end. Rot away slowly, until I'm only dust, a dwindling memory in the dusty database of the universe. Perversely, I cheer up once I've made my decision. I even hum as I plod along. Hey-ho, hey-ho, it's off to die I go. I have a goal now, and it's not the sort of epic goal that I've been chasing since I linked up with Dr. Oystein. No more saving the world for this undead girl. All I have to worry about is making it home and signing off. That's the sort of challenge I was born to deal with. Watch out, afterlife. Here I come. 9. The walk east is taking forever. It's a good thing I'm not in a hurry. I doubt any tourist ever went along this slowly in the past, and that's bearing in mind that sightseers in London weren't known for their speed. They used to drive us locals mad if we got stuck behind a pack of them on a busy street. I'm enjoying the river views. I find the Thames oddly peaceful and calming. I don't normally pay much attention to it, but it demands my focus today on the long, laborious march home. Maybe it's because the serene, constantly flowing water reminds me of the journey my soul is soon to embark on, and I want to believe that my spirit will drift along effortlessly like this when it's set free from my shambolic form. A fool's dream, probably, but a nice image to dwell on while I'm crawling ever eastwards in a fog of nightmarish pain. I stop when I reach the Millennium Bridge, and on an impulse decide to cross the river to the south bank. I've come a long way from Westminster, so I no longer have to worry about running into mutants, and it's a more interesting walk on the south side. I drag myself across the bridge and step off in the shadow of the towering Tate Modern. If I was in better shape, I might pop in to check out the exhibits, but this most certainly isn't a day to be visiting art galleries. I trudge past the Globe, where I spot a zombie in Shakespearean garb, probably an actor from back in the day, standing just inside the entrance. He's making odd jerky movements with his head and arms, and I realize after a few confused moments that he's trying to act out a scene from a dimly remembered play. As drained as I am, I stop and clap slowly. The actor's face lights up with the memory of applause-filled times, and he awkwardly bows towards me. That's my good deed for the day taken care of. I detour down a dark, cobbled street, past an old prison complex that would have been a perfect jail for the likes of Dan Dan and my other foes. I lose sight of the river for a while, before linking up with the path again, just past London Bridge. As I make my slow, shuffling way along the riverbank, I think about where I can pick up a decent power tool. I like to check out in style. A really good, strong drill that will arrow clean through my skull, leaving only the smallest, most discreet of holes behind when I yank it out and drop it while I thrash around and die. I know this area well, both from my human years and the time I spent exploring here over the past months. I'm trying to remember where the best DIY shops are located, but I'm drawing a blank, finding it hard to focus in my sorry, stressed state. What a time to develop Alzheimer's, I growl, jabbing at my head with a fist, trying to knock my senses back into place. My fingers brush against the nails that Dan Dan hammered into my scalp. I pause, wondering if I can drive the nails in deeper, maybe by banging the top of my head against a wall. It could work, I mutter. Puncture the brain and drop me in my tracks. No need to worry about my hands shaking and misdirecting a drill. But what if it doesn't quite kill me? I might just scramble my senses, become a wandering moron. As I'm picking at the nails and mumbling to myself like a madwoman, I catch sight of a familiar vessel and draw bitterly to a halt. The HMS Belfast, where I first met Dan Dan and the other accursed members of the board. The cruiser was a popular tourist draw in the old days, but for me, it's a place of painful memories. I glare at the deserted ship as if it was responsible for the foul crew it played host to, recalling the duels, the zombies I was forced to kill, the torment the humans put me through. I didn't know it at the time, but worse was to come. That being said, this was where my problems with the board began, so I hate this place even more than Battersea Power Station. The memories make me wonder about Justin Bazzini and Vicky Wedge, last seen fleeing from Mr. Dowling's army in Battersea, presumed dead but unconfirmed, and Barnes, the American soldier of fortune who took me captive but later turned hero. When he bid me farewell, he was setting off to try to save his son. I hope he made it. That they were reunited and are lounging on the beach of an island free from zombies. But this world being what it is, I suspect that isn't the case. That Barnes met with a grisly end, while Bazzini and Wedge are living the high life in Buckingham Palace or some other suitably stylish spot. As I'm considering the fates of my old enemies, I spot movement on the deck of the Belfast. A couple of people are playing with a ball, throwing it to one another. I'm instantly wary. Backing up from the edge of the path, I resume my shuffle east. I'm bent over almost double with pain, which is good. That makes me less of a conspicuous target. I don't want to be spotted by whoever is on board what should be a ghost ship. But to my utter lack of surprise, Dame Fortune deserts me yet again. As I'm glancing backwards, one of the people on the deck misses the ball. It bounces over their head and they turn to chase it. Even though I'm almost clear of the cruiser, he or she spies me on the path and stops to check me out. I carry on towards Tower Bridge, draping my left arm over my head. It looks as if I'm doing it to protect my face from the sun, but it also allows me to twist my head around and slyly keep an eye on the Belfast. I'm hoping the pair with the bowl have mistaken me for an ordinary zombie. There's no reason why they shouldn't. In my rough state, I look even worse than most revivids. I'd be hard to peg as a revitalized up close, never mind from a distance. The person who failed to catch the ball shields their eyes and stares. I know the watcher can't see me in detail, given how far away I am and the fact that my back is to them. I don't have anything to worry about. But then the bugger raises a pair of binoculars, and I groan. I can predict what's coming next, and sure enough, a moment later, the person shouts and gestures. He or she is joined by their companion, and that one has binoculars too. They study me for a few seconds, then cast the binoculars aside and race across the deck, no doubt heading for the gangplank. I think about making a dash for it. There are lots of small streets and buildings on the far side of Tower Bridge where I could hide, but I don't have the energy for a chase. Better to make a stand and face whatever manner of foe the universe has chosen to pit against me this time. I limp along a bit farther and draw to a halt outside the weirdly shaped glass structure of City Hall, the mayor's old stomping ground. This seems as fitting a spot to fight as any, a good place to fall if it's my time. I turn stiffly and watch the pair from the Belfast hurrying towards me. I try to crack my knuckles, but they only make a soft, soggy sound when I stretch them. I laugh softly and let my hands fall by my sides. I let my head hang too, not concerned about the identity of my assailants, figuring they can announce themselves if they want to. I won't do them the courtesy of being curious. They come to a stop a few meters from me. I can't see their faces, but I can feel them gaping. I grin tightly, saying nothing, waiting for them to make their move. Finally, one of them says, "B?" It's a girl's voice, not what I was expecting. I don't answer. I think I recognize the voice, but I don't want to raise my hopes. Sure, they'll be dashed if I do. "Is that you, B?" the other one asks, and this time it's a boy. I'm sure I recognize his voice too, but again I'm worried that I might be imagining things. Maybe my metallic ears are distorting the sounds, making me hear what I want to hear. "Who wants to know?" I grunt. "It's us," the girl says. "The twins," the boy adds. At that, I can't help myself. I look up, expecting my eyes to contradict what I've heard. But to my surprise, the vision matches the voices. A boy and girl a few years younger than me, with blonde hair and fair skin. They helped clean me up when I first crawled out of a groove tube all those months ago. "Sian?" I say numbly. "Anya? What are you guys doing here?" "Waiting for you," Anya says. "And playing catch," Cian chuckles. The twins sweep forward and hug me. I can only stare at the top of their heads like a dope, wondering if I'm dreaming. Then Cian says, "What happened to your stomach?" And Anya says, "Ew, gross!" And suddenly, I know it's real. With a cry of shock and delight, I wrap my arms around them, and for the longest time, I just stand there, hugging the young twins hard, without a single other care in the world, all thoughts of suicide forgotten, lost for a short, blissful period, to an emotion I thought I'd never feel again in this undead life. Happiness. 10. Eventually, the twins tire of the hugging and let go. I would have been content to hug them forever, but I don't want to appear like some kind of desperate creep, so I grin shakily and force a weak chuckle. "You guys will never know how relieved I am to see you," I mutter. "Who did you think we were?" Cian asks. "Bad people?" Anya laughs. "The very worst," I tell them, my smile slipping. The twins see the pain on my face. They study my wounds, this time seriously, saying nothing, concern and compassion in their gaze. "Are you okay, Bee?" Anya asks. "Course she's not okay," Cian huffs. "Look at the hole in her stomach. How could anyone be okay when they look like that?" Anya ignores her brother. "How bad is it?" "Pretty damn bad," I admit with a grimace. "But I've plugged up the worst of the damage and made it this far. I can battle on a bit further." "Maybe we could find something to patch you up more efficiently," Anya says. "There are some pharmacies close by. We could get proper bandages, band-aids, anything you need." "It'll take more than that to put me together again," I sniff. "I think even all the king's horses and all the king's men would have a tough time with this one," Cian nods. "Idiot," Anya snorts, and we exchange a look that girls everywhere have been sharing since the dawn of time. Boys.
"So, all kidding aside, what were you doing on the Belfast?" I ask.
"Waiting for you," Cian says.
"Really?"
Anya adds. I frown.
"How did you know I'd come this way?"
"We didn't," Anya says. "But Dr. Oystein hoped you'd return to a place you were familiar with," Cian explains.
"He posted angels here, Battersea Power Station, your old flat," Anya says. "Anyway, he thought you might turn up if you managed to escape."
"He didn't think I was a lost cause?" I ask hoarsely.
"He feared the worst," Anya sighs.
"But he said if anyone could get out of that mad clown's den, it was you," Cian smirks.
"He never gave up on you," Anya says softly.
"He prayed and had faith," Cian whispers.
"And his prayers have been answered,"
Anya finishes with a shy smile. I shake my head wordlessly. I'm overwhelmed. I knew the doc loved us, but for him to pin this much hope on me, to keep the faith, even though he must have known the odds were stacked sky high against me. When I was a child, I believed completely in my dad. I thought he'd always be there for me, that no matter what happened, he would turn up to save me if I got into trouble. It's been a long time since I had that sort of unreserved belief in a person, but Dr. Oystein has restored it, made me feel like a kid again, in all the best ways. "That crazy, beautiful old saint," I croak. Then I remember what I witnessed at County Hall, and my happiness evaporates. "But he should have been looking out for himself. County Hall is fallen. Mr. Dowling attacked. I saw his troops killing everyone. Dr. Oystein is probably dead. He should have focused on his defenses, not wasted his time on a stray wretch like me."
"Easy, B," Anya says. "The doc is fine."
"He doesn't overlook anything," Cian says proudly.
I stare at them uncertainly. "But County Hall did fall. I saw it, just before I came here. The mutants overran it. There were dead bodies piled outside. Mr. Dowling's crew were throwing them onto a bonfire."
Cian and Anya both look downcast.
"Dr. Oystein thought that might happen," Cian says. "He wanted to withdraw everyone," Anya says.
"But Master Zhang convinced him to leave a small group of angels behind," Cian goes on, "to make it look like we were still based in the building.
He didn't want our enemies to know that we moved," Anya says.
"The doc wasn't keen," Cian says glumly. But in the end, he agreed to Master Zhang's plan, Anya concludes.
What plan? I snap. What are you talking about? This isn't making sense.
Anya casts a disapproving look in my direction.
You should know that Dr. Oystein thinks of everything.
Sia nods. He figured we were in trouble as soon as he heard that Mr. Dowling had kidnapped you, and he immediately made plans to move us out of County Hall. I stare at the twins.
You're telling me the doc picked up and left?
Yes, Anya says.
Why?
I croak.
How did he know that Mr. Dowling would attack?
I'm not sure, Anya says. Maybe he just had a feeling.
Or maybe he has spies among the clown's people.
Sian grunts.
Either way, he slipped us out of there, Anya says. We relocated to a base he'd set up ages ago in case we ever needed to evacuate in a hurry.
County Hall might have fallen, but the doc hasn't. Sian smirks.
He's safe, Anya agrees. And he's waiting for us to bring you to him.
My mind is reeling. I don't know how the doc saw this one coming. Then again, I shouldn't be too surprised that he was several steps ahead of me. He's not a dumb foot soldier. It's his job to think things through and make plans in advance, taking all the variables into consideration. Maybe he knew that Mr. Dowling wanted to marry me. Maybe he gambled that I'd accept the clown's proposal for one reason or another, and figured there was a chance that I'd find out where his vial of Schlesinger 10 was stored, and managed to steal off with it. Relocating his base on a hunch was a brave, bold move, but it wouldn't be the first time that Dr. Oystein pinned everything on a gut instinct. I'm so happy that I want to hop around like a lunatic and shout for joy until I'm hoarse, but I can't summon the strength. The best I can manage is a wry smile and a very weak-sounding,
wow.
Come on, Anya says. We'll take you with us. Dr. Oystein will be sad when he finds out those we left behind were killed, but he'll be delighted to see you again.
This is incredible, I chuckle. I can't wait to see him. But how far is it to these new quarters of yours?
Not far, Anya says. It's in Bo, in an old factory where they used to make matches.
That rings a bell.
I think I know the place you're talking about. It was turned into flats. The Bo Quarter, near Victoria Park?
Yes, Sian says, impressed.
How did you know?
I used to live over that way. I've passed it loads of times. It was an eye-catching place.
I consider the walk to Bo. The twins are right. It's not far away. An easy hour if I was in good shape. But in my current condition, it's an unappealing prospect.
I'm not up for the journey, I tell them. It would take hours. I can barely manage a crawl.
We could carry you, Anya suggests.
I don't think so.
We're strong enough, Sian growls, puffing himself up.
I'm sure you are, I reply, but I'd slow you down, and speed is important.
Mr. Dowling's mutants will start looking for me again when they're finished at County Hall. The sooner I can link up with Dr. Oystein, the better.
Sian rubs his chin thoughtfully.
So what do you want us to do? We can't just leave you here, injured and alone.
Tell you what, I decide, thinking about the route east. You guys can help me get to Brick Lane. You need to pass close by it anyway. There's an old brewery there that I know well, where I can lay low. Drop me off and I'll wait there for you to bring Dr. Oystein to me.
Are you sure? Anya frowns.
Maybe it would be safer if one of us stayed with you.
No, I tell her. You two work better as a team. I'll be fine by myself. It's a nice place to rest. Mr. Dowling has no reason to suspect I'll head there.
The twins glance at one another, think about it, then nod.
Okay, Anya says.
If that's what you want, Sian chirps.
Then they move to either side of me, link arms with mine, and we're off, like Dorothy and her friends on the road to Oz. But there's no way I'm going to sing Follow the Yellow Brick Road. I was always a lousy singer, even when I had lungs to sing with.
11.
It takes even longer than I anticipated to cross the river and complete the short march to Brick Lane. The twins are shocked when they see how hard I find it to drag one leg after the other. Anya suggests I stop before Brick Lane and rest up in the Tower of London or Aldgate. But I have the Truman Brewery in my head now, and the lore of it keeps me going. I want to lie back somewhere familiar
study Timothy's paintings, reflect on all that has happened. I'll feel safe there. I'd be uneasy anywhere else. The twins are wearing hats, sunglasses, and jackets to protect them from the daylight. They offer to find the same for me, but I barely notice the discomfort that walking around in the sunshine usually causes. I have far more painful crosses to bear. Eventually, we get to the turning for Brick Lane, and I smile painfully. Home sweet home. You can leave me here. No need to come all the way. Are you sure? Anya asks. What if you're attacked? Cian says. And what if a meteor falls on me? I respond tetterly. Look, even if I collapse, I won't be far off, so you'll know where to find me. By the time I get there, you'll be halfway to Bow. Coming any farther with me would be a waste of time. In that case, we shouldn't have bothered bringing you this far, Cian says, and I feel like giving him a slap. But then he sticks out his tongue and laughs, and I forgive him. Take care, B, Cian says. I will. You're sure you don't want one of us to stay with you? Anya asks. I'm sure. The twins shrug and turn to leave. Hey! I stop them. Thanks. You saved me. I won't forget it. You'd have been fine, Cian snorts. I shake my head slowly. He catches my dark look, and his grin fades. You guys hurry on back, I mutter. They wave at me and set off. Fast as hares now that they don't have me to slow them down. I watch them depart, feeling lonely again, but nowhere near as lost as I did before they linked up with me and told me hope was still alive. Then I turn onto Brick Lane and start hobbling. I pass the first of the legions of curry houses that this street was once famous for, and remember a conversation with Timothy when he offered to cook me a meal. The artist was as loony as Mr. Dowling in his own way, but sweet with it. I still miss him, even though I didn't get to know him that well. I spot a few zombies lurking in the shadows of the restaurants. They can tell with a glance that I'm one of them, so they pay me no mind. It's only as I draw close to my goal that I recall the last time I was here, the day that Mr. Burke tried to kill Dr. Oystein. My old teacher had found me in the brewery, acting as a makeshift curator, taking care of Timothy's paintings. Rage was with him, helping cart a trolley full of folders across the city from wherever they dug them up. Rage and I left Burke there, poring over the paperwork. The next time I saw him, he was insane. He tried to shoot the doc. While subduing Burke, I accidentally infected him, and he turned into a zombie. We knew that Mr. Dowling must have gotten hold of him and fried his brain, because the very last thing he wheezed to me before he lost his humanity was the clown's name. Dr. Oystein was keeping the undead Billy Burke in County Hall at my request, on the off chance that he might revitalize. I wonder if he brought the zombie teacher with him when they moved base, or if he left Burke behind, or set him free. I must ask him when we finish discussing our other business. I liked Burke, and feel guilty for robbing him of his life. I want to do right by him. The front door of the building is open. There are several zombies on the ground floor, standing or sitting, staring off blankly into space, waiting for night to fall. I could shoo them out, but they're not bothering me, so I leave them be. I shuffle forward, meaning to crawl up the stairs to check that Timothy's paintings are in good condition. The artist loved his drawings. They gave his life meaning. I hope Mr. Dowling's mutants didn't destroy or disfigure any of them when they found Burke here and went to work on him. Then, I spot a few folders lying open on the floor and pause. They're some of the files from the trolley that Burke and Rage were lugging through the streets on that awful day. I don't know what my ex-teacher was hoping to find in them, and I don't really care, but the sight of the folders distresses me. They remind me of my history with Mr. Burke, his grisly conversation, the role I played in it. I decide to tidy the place up, return the folders to the trolley, maybe push it out of here if I have the strength. At least that way, I won't have to be forcibly reminded of the good friend that I lost. With a groan, I bend and pick up the nearest folder. I stare at it sadly. Perhaps these were the pages Burke was looking at when Mr. Dowling snuck up on him and struck. The final words he read as a living human, unaware that the end was so close. Curious, I flicked through the pages, trying to put myself in Buck's shoes, to imagine what he might have been thinking about. The pages are densely packed with small print, lots of paragraphs crammed in, technical jargon. I can't understand most of it, and I start to lay the folder aside. Then, I spot a name that stops me. Dowling. I raise the folder again and try reading the paragraph from the first line, but it doesn't make sense taken out of context, so I flick back to the beginning of the chapter and start from there. I'm not a quick reader. Normally it takes me a long time to plow through a chunk of text, but as the significance of what I'm reading sinks in, I find myself flying through the pages. After a while, I put the folder down and numbly pick up one of the others. Again, I find the name of Dowling. It appears often on the pages. If I'd been putting these dossiers together, I'd have been more cautious. I wouldn't have plastered names across them. But the people compiling these reports were confident that they would never be read by the general public. They knew that if all went according to plan, there soon wouldn't even be a general public. Because these are the blueprints for the end of mankind, records of the build-up to the release of the zombie virus. They chart all sorts of activities that were going on worldwide in the months and years before that apocalyptic day. I knew that the virus had been spread on purpose, that corrupt, powerful people had used it to cement their stranglehold on the world. But I had no idea it was this convoluted, or that the players involved were so numerous or devious. In a hollow daze, I pick up another folder to find more of the same. Details of the main participants, politicians, soldiers, scientists, engineers, media moguls. Drawings of complexes, like the one I was housed in as a Zom head, along with plans for the development of zombie-free islands. Lists of the building materials that they sourced, supplies of food, drink, and ammunition that they stockpiled. The files show how the virus was replicated, samples being delivered to major cities and towns, how the global release was coordinated, in many cases, using stooges who had no idea what they were unleashing. The pages explain how lines of communication were brought crashing down to make it harder for the survivors to get in contact with one another and organize a fight back. There are figures outlining payments made. Those who were corrupt were bribed. Those who wouldn't play ball were discredited, humiliated, financially crippled. In certain cases, assassins were hired to execute those with a conscience who were considered a problem. I don't know where Buck found these folders, but they're dynamite. Maybe they were stored in a military safe house that had fallen to Mr. Dowling's mutants, or a surprise zombie attack. He might have learned of the whereabouts of such places when he was working with the army as a spy for Dr. Oystein. I bet Burke didn't realize what he'd laid his hands on until he started reading. His mind must have boggled. What did he feel when he saw the names and started piecing it all together? Terror? Disgust? Panic? I'm not sure, but I know by what happened in County Hall what he felt in the end. Hatred, fury, and madness. I haven't gotten to that stage yet. I'm still in shock, unable to believe what I'm reading, even though it's all laid out clearly. I want to be wrong. I want this to be a smokescreen, something cooked up by vile, merciless individuals, a web of discrediting lies to entrap those who would oppose them. But I'm not that dumb. I can recognize the truth when it's put before me, even though I wish to all the gods that I couldn't. Names. It all comes back to names. Thousands of people are listed in the files. Most of them mean nothing to me, but some are familiar. Justin Bazzini, Daniel, and Luca Wood, Vicky Wedge, world leaders, men and women who owned newspapers and TV stations, heads of major companies. One name in particular keeps cropping up. Dowling. It's linked with everyone of substance who played a crucial part in the downfall of the human race. The sinister and secretive Dowling seems to have been everywhere at once, pulling strings, manipulating anyone who might be of benefit to his foul cause, setting mankind up for its greatest fall. He got balls rolling, pulled in the main instigators of the unholy assault, organized and distributed funds to anyone who could help him. Dowling involved Justin Bazzini and the rest of the board. It was Dowling who flew across the world, meeting presidents, generals and religious gurus, asking for their support, demanding it, extracting it. Dowling, who organized the early experiments, who decided the schedule, who set the date. I never thought one man could wield so much power, so cunningly, so wickedly, so destructively, or that such a man could keep beneath the radar, unknown to the masses, hidden by his underlings, even while he swept across the globe like an undead tsunami. If these files had surfaced before the zombie uprising, they would have provided all the proof needed to blow Dowling's cover, to expose him to the world for the foul-hearted fiend that he was. But I'm not sure it would have made any real difference. He had so much support from those at the highest levels that I think he could have shrugged off the controversy and pushed ahead regardless. Who could have stopped him when the people loyal to him controlled such massive swaths of government, the military, the media, the major religions? I know now why Burke's last word was Dowling. These files would have tipped any sane person over the edge. I was wrong to assume that my old teacher had run into Mr. Dowling and that his brain had been messed with by the clown. It simply went into overload when he read these papers and absorbed so much crushing information all at once. I also realize that when I held Burke in my arms and he croaked the word with his last living breath, I misunderstood his intentions. He was trying to warn me, yes, but of a far greater danger than the one I imagined. I thought I knew the name of my greatest enemy, but I only had it half right. These folders have shown me that the architect of humanity's downfall wasn't my husband, Mr. Albrecht Dowling, lunatic clown, an all-round psycho killer. It was his brother. 12. Dr. Oystein Dowling. 13. I sit hunched over the folders, staring at the words, slowly flicking through the pages now. I feel sick, numb, betrayed. There was only one person in this world that I believed in, one constant in my life that I clung to. No matter what else happened, I was sure I could put my faith in Dr. Oystein, that he would always stand by those who had pledged themselves to his noble cause, that he, maybe he alone, among all the adults I'd ever known, was truly good. How could I have been so wrong? How could he have fooled so many of us for all this time? I must be mistaken. The folders have been crammed with lies. The doc can't be the bad guy. He can't. Nobody that caring and loving could be evil at his core. A vicious criminal mastermind couldn't maintain a warm, considerate front. Not for that long. Not so artfully. I need to ignore the files, the overwhelming evidence they present, the horrible documented neatness of it all. Look for flaws, discrepancies, forgeries. This is probably the work of Mr. Dowling's mutants, or Owlman, or the board, someone who wants to turn Dr. Oystein's supporters against him. I have to mull this over and proceed cautiously, not make any rash decisions until I've spoken with B. Dr. Oystein, in the flesh. I look up and he's there, standing before me, beaming, eyes filled with hope, love, and concern. "I was so worried you wouldn't be here," he cries, striding forward, extending his arms wide to hug me. "I was angry with the twins. One of them should have stayed with you. I had a sick feeling in my stomach all the way here. I was sure Mr. Dowling's men would find you and take you from us again. I think I broke some records as I was racing across from Bo. I didn't know I could run, so..." He draws to a halt, taking in my wounds, my sliced to ribbons face, my ruined torso, the crown of nails hammered into my head, the endless array of cuts, gouges, and scars, the blood-soaked bandages. I've gone through all sorts of torments since the doc last saw me. He shakes his head, horrified.
OB, he whispers, what have they done to you?
I stare at him blankly and say nothing. Was this the work of Dan Dan or Mr. Dowling? Dr. Oystein thunders. I know that Daniel Wood is dead, so there's nothing I can do about that foul specimen. But if the clown did this to you, I will make him pay. Who hurt you, B?
I stare at him blankly and say nothing. Dr. Oystein waits for me to respond. When I don't, he licks his lips and glances at the zombies in the room with us, making sure they don't pose a threat. Then he croaks,
the vial. Mr. Dowling's sample of Schlesinger 10. Is it too much to hope that you might have?
I stare at him blankly and say nothing. Dr. Oystein grimaces.
I'm sorry. That can wait. It was insensitive of me to ask. Maybe the thought never even crossed your mind. We must tend to your injuries. I brought many of your fellow angels with me. They are waiting outside. We will transport you to our new base as carefully as we can. You'll need to rest in a groove tube for a long time. Then I will stitch you together and find replacements for the pieces that have been cut away. I won't lie, you'll never be quite the same again. But I can do more for you than you might imagine.
I stare at him blankly and say nothing.
But first, the doc says brightly, and produces a syringe. This is a concentrated solution of the liquid that we use in the groove tubes. It will act like a shot of adrenaline, restore some of your strength, and ease the worst of the pain. As numb as I am, I know I need that pick-me-up, so I break my silence and mumble,
that sounds good.
Dr. Oystein crouches next to me and takes my right arm. I observe mutely as he tenderly sticks the tip of the needle into a vein and softly pushes down on the plunger. After pumping maybe a fifth of the liquid into my arm, he removes the needle and inserts it into my left arm, then my legs, one after the other.
Our blood does not flow swiftly, he says as he works.
With others, I would inject it into their heart, and it would be slowly pumped around the body, but obviously that is not an option in your case. He smiles briefly, then injects the last of the mixture into my neck.
You should start to notice the effects in a matter of minutes, as your body begins to absorb the solution. You will enjoy only a few hours of relief before your energy ebbs again. But that should be more than enough time for our purposes. I have brought another couple of syringes, just in case, but I do not think we will need them.
Dr. Oystein takes hold of my hand with both of his and squeezes gingerly.
I've been so worried about you, B. I was distraught when I learned that you had sneaked out, that rage had betrayed us, that you had been taken prisoner. If I could have done anything to rescue you, believe me, I would have. But my hands were tied. I had to simply wait and hope and pray.
I stare at the good doctor and fight the urge to curl my upper lip. I tell myself again I shouldn't jump to conclusions, that there could be more to this than what the folders imply. I have to give him a chance to defend himself. I don't want to accuse him, only to look like an ungrateful fool when he blows the accusations out of the water. As my flesh tingles and vitality returns to my limbs, I try to think of a subtle way to broach the taboo topic. I don't find one, but I do recall my initial meeting with the doc, and that provides me with my opening line.
You said that Oystein was your first name.
His eyes crinkle.
Pardon? That first day we met, when you were showing me round County Hall, you jokingly said that you'd almost forgotten what your surname was.
Dr. Oystein chuckles.
You have a good memory. You never did tell me,
I press.
It's not important, he says lightly.
I think it is, I contradict him.
Let's play a game.
What sort of a game? He asks, letting go of my hand and staring at me with a quizzical expression, half smiling, half concerned, not sure where I'm going with this.
Let's call it the Rumpelstiltskin game.
I grin humorlessly. That was one of my favorite stories when I was a kid, especially the bit where the girl has three chances to guess his name.
We do not have time for this, B,
he mutters, and I can tell by the way his expression changes that he knows I've revealed his secret. The dark, spiteful look that flashes across his face is all the confirmation I need that the folders are telling the terrible truth. But I carry on anyway, not wanting to believe the worst until I hear him admit it.
Oh, there's always time for a good game, I say grimly. Let me think. Is your name... Oystein Smith. When Dr. Oystein is silent, I pull a long face and answer for him. No. So is it Oystein Jones? Again he's silent, and again I answer on his behalf. No. Last chance. Could it possibly be Oystein? I start to make a drawn-out D sound, but he cuts me short.
Darling, he says quietly.
Yes, B. You are correct. I am Oystein Dowling. And Albrecht is my estranged brother. I moan wretchedly. I didn't think it would be this easy, that he'd admit his guilt so swiftly. In a way, I wish it had been harder. If he tried to deny the accusation, I could have gone on believing for a while that it might not be true. Dr. Oystein lowers his gaze. I expect him to attack me, or to start offering up excuses, but he only looks around sadly at the folders, taking note of them for the first time.
I assume you found out through these, he says with a sigh. Nobody was meant to keep a record of what we were doing. I often stress the need to leave no paper trail, but people cannot escape their nature. I guess that some would disobey my orders, in case they needed the documents to blackmail me, or point the finger of blame solely in my direction. Humans are so predictable.
He picks up one of the folders and studies the pages, tutting softly. I suppose Billy Burke tracked these down. That explains why he tried to kill me. I couldn't be sure the day he came after me. I hoped that my brother had put him up to it, but Billy didn't strike me as a madman when he stormed into County Hall, just somebody who was very angry. I should have retraced his steps and destroyed the incriminating evidence, but I would have had to investigate by myself. It was not a task I could have set one of my angels to do. If I was wrong and he had fallen foul of Albrecht, I didn't want to walk into a trap and end up in my brother's clutches. So, I turned a blind eye to the event and hoped it would not come back to haunt me. That was a foolish mistake. I have not made many of those over the decades.
Is it true? I hiss. Did you do this?
I wave a hand at the folders. Dr. Oystein nods slowly.
Yes.
I want to hit him with my most barbed insult, but there isn't a curse strong enough to convey what I'm feeling. And if I scream, the angels outside will rush to his rescue. So I don't bother with words. Instead, I hurl myself at the century-old zombie and haul him to the ground. We roll across the floor, and I scrape his face. A couple of finger bones dig deeply into his left cheek, scarring him. He doesn't react. I land on top of the dock and punch wildly, pummeling his stomach, his chest, his face. He doesn't react. I grab his head and bang it down hard on the floor. If I had all my strength, I'd smash his skull open and end this clash immediately. But as things stand, I can only hope to scramble his brains inside their protective covering. He doesn't react. I wrap my hands round his throat and throttle him, knowing I can't kill him that way, but wanting to hurt him, to make him cry out, to see pain and fear in his eyes. He only stares at me miserably.
Say something, you bastard, I groan, shaking his shoulders.
He spits blood from his lips and croaks.
I cannot. Tell me why you did it.
Not here, he says.
Not now. I'll kill you,
I growl.
No one will blame you if you do, he replies calmly.
Not once you show them the evidence against me. They will probably hail you as a hero.
You destroyed the world, I cry.
Yes, he says, and his face crumples. I don't see any of the things in his expression that I expected, such as joy, pride, malice. Only misery and grief. I let go of the defenseless doctor and push myself away.
B, he says, sitting up.
Before he can say anything else, I put all of my returning energy into my right foot and kick the side of his head as hard as I can. He slumps sideways, not unconscious but stunned. It will take him a few minutes to recover. I bend over the gasping doctor and rifle through his pockets. I find the pair of syringes that he mentioned and relieve him of them. I think about stabbing them through his eyes, one for each eyeball. If I stuck them through the sockets and deep into his brain, I could finish him off. But how can I kill this man who has done so much for me?
He rescued me when I was at my lowest. He took me in and showered me with love. He was like my father, only better. I owe so much to Dr. Oystein, more than I ever owed to anyone. He guided me, taught me how to put my darker ways behind me, helped me become who I am. If I'm furious and contemptuous now, it's only because he told me to expect more of people. I hate him so savagely, only because I love him so dearly. It's not for the likes of me to pass judgment on a man like Oystein Dowling, so I take the only option open to a desperate creature in my bewildering predicament. I leave the doc moaning and writhing on the floor. I hurry to the stairs, clutching the syringes tightly, and I run. 14. I wouldn't have made it to the top of the first set of stairs several minutes ago, but as I'm juiced up with Dr. Oystein's concoction, the steps no longer present a major problem. I lurch up them, growing in strength all the time. I'm still in bad shape, and I sting and ache all over, but coming off the end of my recent lows, I feel like I've been given bionic implants. I make it to the roof and pause to assess my options. I can hear the angels out front, murmuring softly, calmly, with no idea yet what has happened inside. I race along the roof and climb down a drainpipe into the yard at the rear of the building. I hurry across, let myself out of the yard, and jog down a long road, then start zigzagging my way southeast, hoping to lose myself in the maze of streets. I didn't think I'd be fleeing for my life again this soon, or that I'd be running from Dr. Oystein and his angels. Amazing how the world can turn on its head so suddenly. I silently curse myself as I run, for not killing Dr. Oystein. It was crazy letting him live. But I know I'd do the same thing if the chance presented itself again. I love him too much to take his life, even after hearing his most heinous confession. There's also the crazy hope that there was a good reason for what he did. If I'd heard him out, maybe he could have explained it in a way that made sense. At the same time, that possibility was why I ran. I was afraid he'd convince me that the slaughter of billions could be justified. I know in my missing heart of hearts that there can be no excuse for unleashing the zombie virus, but I think he could have provided one regardless. If he had, and I'd bought his story, I might have forgiven him and carried on working with him. That would have made me as guilty as he is, and I don't want such a stain on my conscience. Some things in this world should be unacceptable no matter what. Sometimes you shouldn't allow people to gray your vision, to make you stop seeing an atrocity in simple black and white terms. I remember discussing the Holocaust once with Vinyl and a few of my other mates. I told them my dad had said that the number of victims had been vastly exaggerated, that certain groups wanted to make it seem worse than it was, in order to squeeze extra sympathy out of people worldwide. According to him, only a few hundred thousand Jews had been killed, and in concentration camps, not death camps. Vinyl stood up at that point and snarled at me. He said he had a simple policy when it came to Holocaust deniers. As soon as they started spouting crap, no matter how reasonable it might sound, he walked away, because some things were never worth listening to. And off he stormed. The rest of the gang followed him, or went home, heads low and unusually silent, leaving me to glower at the pavement by myself. I felt very small that day, angry at Vinyl for humiliating me, but also angry at myself for being willing to believe my dad's distortions of the truth. I knew Vinyl was right, and I know he'd act the same way today if he was still here. He's not, but I can at least do his memory justice. It's not much of a comfort, but I'm sure my old friend would be proud of me if he could see the way I cut Dr. Oystein off before he could start spinning his seductive lies. Yeah, but he'd have been prouder if I'd rammed the steel-tipped end of one of Timothy's paintbrushes through the old goat's skull. I allow myself a wry chuckle at the thought of bringing Dr. Oystein down with such an unlikely weapon. Then I hear the sound of footsteps, and I fall silent and listen. The runners aren't making a lot of noise, but in a city of the undead, it's just about impossible to mask the echoes of dozens of feet slapping on the pavement. There are lots of people tearing after me, and I'm certain they're angels.
Master Zhang will be furious when he finds out how his students reacted. They should have come in smaller gangs and padded softly, sacrificing speed for stealth. I wouldn't want to be in their shoes when they report back to him. Unless, of course, they capture me. Nobody will care then. I'm surrounded by houses. Many of their doors are ajar, either left that way by their owners when they fled, or forced open by zombies. I slip into one of the deserted shells, not touching the door, and position myself in the shadows of a room, with a window overlooking the street. The angels come tearing past. They're in a pack, hunting like dogs. No sign of Dr. Oystein, which makes me suspect he's led another group in a different direction. I figure they probably split into four teams, maybe more. They want to cover the main routes out, north, south, east, and west. If I'm right about that, their apparent clumsiness begins to make sense. As bright as I feel, it's only relative to how poorly I felt before. I'm nowhere near as strong or fast as the other angels. I only have a few minutes head start on them, so they know I can't have gone far. My colleagues aren't racing after me in a disorganized rush, as I first assumed. They're running to get ahead of me. When they're sure they've outpaced me, they'll stop, break into smaller groups, and track back, examining every street and alley, every building and house. There won't be enough of them to cast an impenetrable net across the area, but it will be hard to slip through. Clever sods. Strangely, I'm proud of them. Pleased to see they haven't lost their heads when the heat is on, even though I'm the scared rabbit that they're hunting. I've got two choices. I can find somewhere to hide and hope they don't root me out, or I can try to sneak through the closing web of angels undetected. In a city like London, there are more hiding places than a person could count. There's no way the angels can check everywhere. It wouldn't be a sign of cowardice if I laid low. Just a mark of common sense. But then I'd be like Anne Frank and others who hid during the Second World War. It worked for some of them and they evaded capture, but it must have been horrible, holed up in the gloom, knowing they were doomed if their enemies found them, flinching at every unexpected sound or movement. I don't want to saddle myself with the fear, the tension, the paranoia every time a rat scuttles past. Also, my newly regained strength won't last. I feel reasonably fine now, but I won't in a few hours. Even if I inject myself with the other syringes, I'll only buy myself half a day, maybe a day at best, and I'm sure the angels won't abandon the search that swiftly. Flight is my preferred option. If I'm going down, I want to go down fighting, in the open, not cornered and helpless. It would make sense to slip into the sewers and try to lose them in the dark, but I've spent enough time underground. I'm sick of the tunnels and bunkers. I belong up here, in the land of day and night. I step out of the shadows, a devil-may-care smirk on my face. I stride back through the doorway and out onto the road. I continue the way I was headed, and inside my head, I issue a challenge to the big bad world. Come get me, suckers! 15. I cross Whitechapel Road and continue southeast, looking to hit Limehouse at some point. I did think about reversing direction and heading west, since Dr. Oystein's new base is situated in the East End, but they might anticipate that. In their position, I'd focus the majority of my forces north and west, the areas where a fugitive would be most likely to run. Of course, they might have anticipated my anticipation and sought to second-guess me, but I'm not going to drive myself crazy by thinking like that. I go slower than previously, listening, watching. Cunning will serve me better than speed right now. It's a game of cat and mouse, and since I can't outrun the hunters, I need to outsmart them. I keep to the inner sides of paths, ready to duck into a building if I catch sight of any angels, but the streets seem to be deserted. The zombies are resting in the shade, while the living abandoned their claim to the pavements long ago. I spot movement ahead and throw myself through the broken window of a coffee shop. I look for weapons, but there's not much that will be of any use in a fight. In the end, I grab a couple of long spoons. If I can't stab, at least I can gouge. I position myself close to the door, figuring it will be better to strike as they enter, rather than wait in the back for them to come find me. I hold the spoons loosely, biding my time. There are shuffling sounds outside and I prepare for battle. Then a zombie stumbles into view and I relax. It's an old woman, green moss growing thickly across her collarbone, where she was bitten when alive. One of her eyes has been torn out. It looks like a relatively fresh wound. She's moaning softly. I can tell she's hungry, in even more pain than most of her kind. Desperate for the brains that will ease her suffering. Willing to brave the discomfort of the daylight world, in order to search for scraps that the faster, sharper zombies might have missed during their night maneuvers. The zombie turns her eye on me, determines I'm no good to her, and pushes on. I feel sorry for the old biddy, but there are millions more in her lousy position, and there's nothing I can do for her. Then, I have an idea, and step out after the woman. I thought when I first saw her that she was an angel, so there's a good chance that if any angels catch sight of her, they might think she's me. Some of them will probably have stationed themselves in houses keeping watch, hoping I'll pass by. The zombie might lure them out, or distract others who are on the street. I can use her as a diversion, follow at a distance, duck for cover if I spy anyone darting towards her. I wait for the pitiful old lady to get a good way ahead of me, then trail after her, matching her sluggish pace, letting her act as my unwitting decoy. As long as she keeps going in the direction that I want, she'll be a good addition to the team. We inch along, an unlikely partnership. I cover as many angles as I can, looking behind, left, right, my head snapping around like an agitated bird's. A shadow passes overhead. I look up immediately, but there's nothing there. Lots of small clouds are scattered across the sky. I guess the shadow must have been one of those, though it seemed to scud by too swiftly for a cloud. The old woman pauses to pick through some overturned bins in the middle of the road. I don't know what she expects to find. I'm annoyed by the delay, and think about cutting her loose and going my own way again. I keep glancing up, unsettled, not convinced that the shadow was a cloud, but telling myself that I'm just being paranoid. This is the reason I didn't want to hole up. When your brain gets spooked, you start to see trouble everywhere. Eventually, the zombie abandons the bins and pads onwards. She rounds a corner. I shuffle after her, but before I can turn into the new road, someone leaps from the roof of the building and lands in front of me. I'm still holding the spoons from the coffee shop. I raise them defensively, then lower them when the guy straightens up and faces me. He's a good-looking teenage boy with dark hair and fashionable, trendy clothes. He's usually a cheerful sort, but his face is clouded with anger now.
"You are in so much trouble," Carl Clay growls.
"Tell me about it," I sniff. "Are the others with you?"
"Of course,"
he whistles, and Shane and Ashtart step out of the hairdresser's. The ginger Shane is in his customary tracksuit, tacky gold chains dangling from his neck. Ashtart is wearing a blue robe and a golden headscarf. I thought my injuries would provoke a reaction, but Dr. Oystein must have told them about my sorry state, because they barely spare my horror show of a body a second glance. They both look as pissed off as Carl, too angry to bother with sympathy or concern.
"It's like a class reunion," I chuckle, as my ex-roommates from County Hall gather in front of me.
"A pity Jacob is missing. That would have made a full set."
"Rage too," Shane says.
"Nah," I grunt. "He was never one of us. Not really."
The angels eyeball me, and I return their gaze silently.
"You must be out of your mind," Carl finally hisses. "Assaulting the dock? Taking off like a bat out of hell?"
I shrug.
"What did he tell you?"
"That you were upset," Ashtart says icily. "He said you were not yourself, that it was imperative we find you, but we should not hurt you unless we had absolutely no other option. We were not to approach you, but to send for him, so that he could confront you personally."
"Sly old Dr. Oystein," I sneer. "He wanted me all to himself.
No surprise there."
"What are you talking about?"
Carl frowns. I shake my head. "It doesn't matter.
Have you sent word to him?
No, Ashtart says.
We want you to come freely. We do not know why you struck Dr. Oystein, but if you surrender willingly, we are sure this can be worked out.
We were over the moon when we found out you were alive, Shane says. We don't want to lose you now.
We're sure it's not your fault,
Carl snorts. Mr. Dowling must have messed with your mind when he was slicing up your body. The doc will be able to help you get your head back in order. He'll clear up everything if you give him a chance.
You don't have a clue, I huff. I've been through hell since you last saw me. But that had nothing to do with why I attacked Dr. Oystein. He's not what he seems. He's been playing us for fools.
It's all right, Carl says soothingly. He told us you'd say stuff like this. The clown has turned you against us, so you think we're the enemy. That's okay. The doc will set your brain straight again. But you have to come with us, B. We can take you by force if necessary, but we'd rather not.
You need to trust us, Ashtart says. We are your friends. We care about you. We want to help.
I know you do, I mutter sadly. But you don't have all the facts.
There's nothing wrong with my brain. I unearthed a secret while I was waiting for the doc. It changed everything. Give me 5 minutes and I can explain it all. Then I'll show you the proof, if the doc hasn't already disposed of it. 5 minutes isn't too much to ask, is it? After all we've been through together?
The three angels look at one another, considering my request.
No, Ashtart sighs. There is nothing to discuss. We will not let you level false accusations against Dr. Oystein.
You don't know what you're saying, B, Carl says sympathetically. You'd be wasting your time trying to make us believe your lies.
Give it up, Shane grunts. There are four of us to one of you. You don't stand a chance.
You never were good at math, numbnuts, I sneer. There's only three of you.
Four,
someone with an American accent says softly behind me. I whirl and spot a ghost from my past.
Bonds? I cry.
The ex-soldier and one-time hunter of zombies looks grim. He's dressed in dark clothes, a rifle strapped across his back, a handgun in a holster dangling from his left hip. There are more streaks of gray in his black hair than I remember. He's still got a bullet jammed behind his right ear. He's pointing a taser at me, and is packing a couple of spares in his other hand.
Hello again, Becky Smith,
Bond says solemnly.
What the hell are you doing here?
I gasp, wondering if I'm imagining things in my addled state.
I've been back in London a while now, Bond says quietly. I turned up at County Hall not long after you'd left, to offer my services to Dr. Oystein.
Bonds was the one who led us to you, Shane says admiringly. He guessed your most likely route and brought us with him to intercept you. He told us how to search for you.
You haven't lost your old hunting skills, I snarl, fixing my gaze on the taser, getting ready to throw myself out of the way of the dart-like electrodes as soon as he fires.
Look me in the eye, B, Bond says softly.
Get stuffed,
I jeer, moving sideways, preparing a battle plan, trying to keep sight of the angels while watching Bonds's trigger finger.
B, Bond says more firmly. I want to see your eyes.
Something in his voice makes me look up. We lock gazes, and he stares at me with a calm, hard expression. I'd been brandishing the spoons, hoping to ward off any incoming blows, but now I let them drop, knowing I can't fend off a warrior of Bonds's stature with a couple of useless bits of cutlery. The game is truly up.
Go on then, you bastard, I croak bitterly. Knock me out and take me to your precious new master, the same way you served me up to your old bosses.
Dr. Oystein isn't the same as Justin Bazzini or the Wood Brothers, Bond says.
You're right there, I agree.
He's worse. See what they've done to her, Carl says miserably.
Yes, Bonds murmurs, not breaking our connection, looking into me almost as deeply as Mr. Dowling used to.
I see.
Then his jaw sets, and he takes a step back. Before I can react, he raises the taser, aims swiftly but carefully, and fires.
16.
The barbed electrodes shoot through the air and find their target. The taser buzzes as electricity shoots through it, and I wince in anticipation of my muscles spasming, my limbs stiffening involuntarily, before I collapse and thrash about like a dying snake. But to my surprise, I don't fall. Not a single muscle twitches. After a confused moment, I realize that's because Barnes didn't shoot me. He shot Shane. As Carl and Arshtart gape, Barnes calmly takes the second of his three tasers and shoots Carl, who falls next to Shane. Arshtart recovers his senses and turns to run, but Barnes is too quick, even for a revitalized zombie. The electrodes catch her between the shoulder blades, and she goes down with a strangled cry. Barnes leaves the electrodes attached to the tasers and doesn't cut the power. He lays the hand units down, checks to make sure that each is functioning, then sets his sights on me.
That's the same sort of taser I used when I captured you outside Hamley's, he says. One blast should knock each of them out of action for a good while, long enough for us to get away. But I don't believe in taking chances. I'll leave them running. They won't cause any permanent damage.
I don't get it, I say warily. Why are you doing this if you're Dr. Oystein's man?
I'm nobody's man except my own, he replies stiffly. I quit taking orders the day I severed my ties with the board. I worked for Oystein because I believed in him.
And now? I ask. He shrugs.
I believe in you more. You're the reason I came back. I never forgot how you fought every day to spare the lives of those children on the Belfast, even though you had no ties to them. I left London to try to save my son, but I couldn't shake the feeling that I should have stayed to fight with you. When I got done with my other business, I reckoned I might put my dubious talents to their best use if I threw in my lot with you. So here I am.
I stare at the tall, serious-looking man, wondering if this is a trick.
How can I trust you? I growl.
He smiles wearily.
If you tell me not to come with you, I'll let you go. I found you once, so I could probably find you again, but I won't come looking if you ask me not to.
And Dr. Oystein? I press.
He won't be impressed when he finds out you've betrayed him. Barnes snorts. I knew there was something wrong when he came out of the brewery without you. He fed his angels a load of crap, claimed Mr. Dowling had done something to your mind, that you were out of control. But that's not the story the twins told when they reported back. According to them, you were in bad shape physically but fine mentally.
Barnes looks around impatiently.
We don't have time for this conversation. Not here in the open. I don't know what's happened between you and Dr. Oystein, but I can smell a rat. I doubt you would have fled without good cause, and I don't think he'd have sent his troops after you if he wasn't desperate to get you back. Desperate men worry me. I have little faith in them.
You're crazy, I laugh. Barnes doesn't crack a smile.
I feel I owe you for all that you suffered on the Belfast, since I was the one who delivered you to Dandan and the others. I'll help you if you want, or release you, if that's what you prefer. Just give me the nod.
I think it over quickly, and decide to gamble on his support.
Come on, then, I grunt, and off I set. No longer alone, and no longer as vulnerable as I was. I don't want to jinx myself, but with Barnes by my side, I just might make it out of this trap. There's hope for the bee yet.
17. Barnes takes the lead and I'm happy to follow. I like waving on the responsibility. I've carried the torch long enough. Let somebody else do the planning and worrying for a while. It makes a nice change. The ex-soldier sets a slow pace, not much faster than the speed I was going before I fell in behind the one-eyed zombie. Aren't you worried we might run into other angels? I ask.
Hush, he says. The angels don't bother me, but zombies do. If they see or hear us talking, they might investigate, and I don't want to have to flee from a pack of brain munchers.
I'd forgotten that the undead were a threat to the likes of Barnes. I'm full of questions, but I keep my mouth shut, respecting the silence. Now that I study him, I see that he's not just walking slowly, but swinging his arms and rolling his head, the way many zombies do. He's mimicking the movements of a revived, to divert the interest of any undead observers who might be wondering about the couple of figures swanning around in the sunshine. He also covers his head with his arms ever so often, as if the rays are paining him, I haven't a clue what time it is. But, to judge by the setting sun, we don't have much daylight left to play with. I think of mentioning that to Barnes, but I'm sure he's even more aware of it than I am. The streets of London are deadly for the living at night. Barnes leads me south into Wapping. I don't think that's a good idea. The streets are narrow here, the buildings pressing in tightly above them. Easy to fall foul of a flash zombie attack and get pinned down. But he seems to know what he's doing, and he starts to pick up the pace, negotiating the streets as if he's familiar with them. We don't run into any angels. I'm glad of that. As far as I can see, Barnes is out of tasers, leaving him only with his guns. I'd rather not harm any of my old allies. They weren't part of Dr. Oystein's conspiracy. They don't know what the dark is really like. As the sun starts to set over the city, freeing the undead to come out in their hordes, we arrive at a pub called the Prospect of Whitby. The windows have been boarded over and the door is locked. To my surprise, Barnes produces a key. As the door opens and we slip inside, I whisper, "That wasn't a skeleton key." "No," Barnes says, closing the door behind him and flicking on a light. "This was one of my bases in the old days, when I was running with Coley. We shored up several places like this around the city, so we could stay in them at night when we needed to. We'll be safe here." Barnes pushes through the pub, switching on another few lights. He goes all the way to the back door, opens it and steps out onto a balcony overlooking the river to check something. He's smiling when he returns. "The last time I was here, I left a boat tied up outside. It's still there. We have that as a backup if we need to make a quick getaway. It's not much of a craft, but it'll get us safely out of here if zombies attack from the front."
"You think of everything," I chuckle.
"No," he sighs, "but I try to." Barnes fetches a bottle of beer from a fridge, opens it and finishes off half with his first gulp.
"Damn, that was good,"
he gasps, setting it down. "I'd almost forgotten what beer was like, even when it's well past its sell-by date. I'd offer you one, but I know it would run clean through you."
"I'm too young for alcohol anyway," I smirk.
"Sure," he laughs. "Like you never sank a sneaky beer or two in your misspent youth?"
We smile at one another, and I take a seat close to him, but not so close that I might accidentally scratch him if he was to stumble. My smile fades as I remember something. "You mentioned Coley a minute ago."
Barnes grins. "Poor old Coley. I felt bad for turning on him the way I did, tying him up before I rescued you from the board. I went back and set him free. He was mad as hell. Would have tried to kill me, except he figured I'd take him in a fair fight. But he swallowed his pride and actually asked to come with me. He knew he stood a better chance of getting out of London if he had someone to watch his back. But I could never have trusted him. I made my excuses and left. Haven't heard anything about him since. I guess that's the last I'll ever see or hear of him."
"Well, it's definitely the last you'll see of him." I sniff and proceed to tell Barnes about how Coley teamed up with Dandan again, and how his master killed him when the zombies overran Battersea Power Station. Barnes is grim-faced when I finish.
"Fool," he snaps. "He deserved what he got, siding with a monster like that. We didn't know about the children when we signed up to work for the board. But to understand what Dandan was truly like, and to go back for more." He spits with disgust. Then his expression softens.
"Still, we were a team for a long time. I hoped he'd fare better than that."
"At least it was quick," I note.
"Yeah," Bond says glumly. "We should all be so lucky."
He sips his beer, and I give him a few moments of silent reflection. Then I clear my throat as tactfully as I can.
"What about your son?"
"Stuart," Bond says softly, staring at the label on the bottle.
"Did you find him?"
Bonds doesn't answer. His son was the reason he caught me and handed me over to the board. They'd granted the boy sanctuary on a zombie-free island that their people were managing. The child was safe as long as his father cooperated with Bazzini and his cronies. But then Barnes betrayed them and led the angels to my rescue. Barnes finishes the beer and gets another. I say nothing, determined not to ask any more questions, not wanting to upset him.
but after a while he looks up and volunteers the information. It took me longer to get to the island than I imagined. A lot of roads to the coast were blocked. I had to work my way around them. I ran into scores of zombies. But I got there in the end. I kept going. For Stuart. The ex-soldier's fingers tighten on the bottle, and I know what's coming next. Bazzini, or one of his team, had radioed ahead. Told the people on the island what I'd done and issued new instructions. I found Stuart's remains. They left him hanging over the harbor. He was still there when I reached the island. Well, whatever the crows hadn't bothered with. Bonds falls silent again, his gaze distant, a world of pain in his expression. Did you kill them? I ask softly. He shakes his head slowly. I don't blame them. They were following orders. I knew what the rules were when I signed up to the deal. I broke them, so it was my fault, nobody else's. There are always consequences when you agree to a deal with evil men. After what I did on the Belfast? Bond sighs. Anyway, I cut down what was left of Stuart, buried him, and got the hell out of there, unseen and unheard.
Do you regret it? I ask quietly. Telling Dr. Oystein about me, leading him to the Belfast, breaking your contract with the board. Would you do it differently if you could go back in time?
Bond grunts. No. If you're a damn fool once, you'll be a damn fool twice. What they were doing on the Belfast was wrong. I'd always known they were a crooked bunch, but I was able to turn a blind eye to their shortcomings. I'm no saint myself, so I didn't feel any right to take the moral high ground. But when I realized the full extent of their vileness, of what Daniel Wood was doing to those children...
There are some things in this life that you can't stand for,
he says, which is similar to what I'd been telling myself earlier in the day.
I love Stuart more than anything else in this world, but sometimes you have to make a sacrifice for the greater good. I'm not sure if Stuart would have understood that. It wasn't really something I understood myself until I saw those children on the Belfast. I wish I could have one last conversation with my boy to explain.
I'm sorry, I croak. Bond sniffs, waves my apology away, then has another gulp of his beer and tries to forget the awful loss that his decency has cost him. 18. It wouldn't have surprised me if Barnes had carried on drinking, to wash away the memories and sleep the dreamless sleep of a drunkard, but he stops after the second bottle. I assume that he wants to be alert if we have to move out in a hurry.
You hungry?
Barnes asks, pulling some dried goods out of a chest. That stuff's no good for me, I snort.
I know, he says, but I have brains, too. I keep them in a freezer out back. I had a look when I was checking the boat. The power to the freezer went a while ago, but I think the meat's still fresh enough to be of use.
What are you doing with brains? I frown.
Coley and I kept a supply. We use them to bait zombies and lure them into traps.
Very humane, I mutter, my expression hardening.
Bond shrugs. I make no apologies for being a hunter. I don't regret killing brain-dead zombies. They're savage abominations, and this world is well rid of them. I'm sorry for what I did to you, but that's as far as my regrets extend. The dead should stay dead, and if they don't, the living have every right to put them down.
I shift uncomfortably. I want to argue the point with him, but how can I, when just a few hours ago I was plotting to unleash a virus that would wipe out every zombie on the planet? Bond's cut down dozens or hundreds of revivids in his time. If I'd been successful, I'd have eliminated billions. Get the damn brains, I huff.
Bond grins and fetches me a slice of chilled head cheese. It's not the most appealing chunk of brain I've ever been faced with. A light mold has spread across it since it defrosted, but it hasn't totally dried out, so it should still provide me with the nutrients I need.
As I take it from him, he settles back and his grin spreads.
I can't wait to see this.
What are you talking about? I snap.
I want to see how a stomachless zombie eats.
I stare at Barnes, then at the hole in my middle. Hell, I hadn't thought about that.
You haven't eaten in a while? He asks.
Not since most of my stomach was ripped away. I think about it, then take an explorative bite. I work it down my throat, but once it clears my chest,
The chunk simply drops into the pit where my bowels used to be. Plop, Bond's deadpans.
I'm glad you're enjoying this so much, I scowl. If I can't eat, I can't extract the nutrients that I need to keep my brain ticking over. I'll relapse and become a revivid again.
There's no fear of that, Bond says. I've seen zombies in worse shape than you chowing down and getting whatever it is that they need from the brains. Go with your instincts and see where they lead you.
I stare at the chunk of brain in my hand and try to tune out my thoughts, to focus on the food and let my natural reactions take over. It's easier than I thought it would be. And a minute later, I find myself mashing the brain up in my mouth, working it into a paste. Then I spit the paste into my hands and scrape it around the walls of my stomach, covering as much of the cavity as I can with the grisly goo.
Fascinating, Barnes purrs. You don't have to gape, I growl. I know how disgusting this is.
No, he says. This is better than primetime TV. Is it doing the job? Do you think you'll be able to sustain yourself?
Yeah, I can already feel myself absorbing the richness of the meat. I'll scrape off the gunk soon, so as not to attract insects. But it's pretty much the same as when I ate before. Except now I don't have to puke the brains back up. So in a way, it's even better.
You'll set a trend, Barnes laughs, and tucks into his own food, which looks a hell of a lot more appetizing than mine.
Barnes carefully washes his plate when he's finished and throws the remains of my mashed-up meal into the Thames so that the scent doesn't attract any passing zombies. I join him on the balcony and stare out across the river. Night has settled over the city, and I can hear the moans and cries of its undead population as the revivids take to the streets in search of the ever-diminishing supplies of gray matter. Brains must be hard to come by now. The vast majority of zombies are surely in agony. I think the noise will worsen over the coming months, until maybe it's one solid 24-hour-long scream, every single day of the week for the next few thousand years.
I don't know why they stay, Bond says quietly. Surely they'd be better off in the countryside, where they might find the odd wild animal to feast on.
There are still lots of animals here, I tell him. We can smell their brains. But they're fast and they hide, and they're able to adapt. The revivids are slower to change. Maybe they never properly will. But as long as the scent of brains lingers, zombies will prowl the streets. They don't have the sense to move on.
It's a hell of a world,
Bond says bitterly, then heads back inside. I stay on the balcony a few minutes longer, listening to the howls of my brethren, wishing I could cry, or failing that, cast aside my consciousness and join them. But since I can't and won't, I turn my back on the tortured shrieks of the city's damned souls and follow Barnes into the pub, where we can shut the door on the night and act for a while as if all is as it was when the world was the domain of the living.
19. So tell me about Dr. Oystein, Barnes says.
You mean Dr. Dowling, I correct him. When Barnes raises an eyebrow, I explain about the folders, how Dr. Oystein's surname is Dowling, how the doc confirmed that he's Mr. Dowling's brother, that he was the main figure behind the release of the zombie virus. I don't think Barnes is often left speechless, but he can't say anything for a long time after I finish. He stares at me as if I have two heads. That doesn't surprise me. I find it as bizarre as he does.
I don't understand, he finally mumbles. Oystein has saved so many people. All of his time is dedicated to trying to eradicate the undead and hand control back to the living.
That's what he says, I snort. But I think it's a sham. He's been looking to get his hands on Schlesinger 10. We thought...
What's Schlesinger 10?
Barnes interrupts. A virus he concocted. It can wipe out every living person, leaving the zombies free to rule the world alone. Our man stole it from him before he could put it to use, and gave it to Mr. Dowling.
Hold on. Bond stops me. I'm getting confused. Owlman and Mr. Dowling are the villains here, aren't they?
Well, they're definitely not the heroes. I laugh, then shake my head. It's complicated. Mr. Dowling loves chaos, so he wants to keep things as they are. The undead pitted against the living.
him in the middle, relishing the bloodshed. He's not good or bad as we see it, just totally bonkers. But at least he wasn't planning to wipe out humanity. That much we know for sure, since he could have uncorked his vial of Schlesinger 10 at any time.
Okay, Bonds nods. Not an ally, but not a direct foe either.
Oh, he's definitely a foe, I disagree. Just not a foe who wants to kill all of the living.
What about Owlman? Bonds asks.
I purse my lips. He's more difficult to pin down. I've no idea what his motives are. He was involved in the spread of the zombie virus. His name was all over the files. But at the same time, he didn't release the sample of Schlesinger 10 when it was in his possession. So I guess he's not trying to annihilate every living human either.
Bonds frowns. So you're saying Oystein is the only one who wants to use this virus to kill us all?
It looks that way, I shrug.
Then why didn't he simply recreate it after the first batch had been stolen?
Bonds asks. I make a small humming noise as I think about that. Maybe he couldn't. Mr. Dowling was his partner before they fell out with one another, and Owlman was their assistant. Maybe one of those two was instrumental in figuring out the formula, and the doc couldn't replicate it without their help. He was able to make Clemens 13, but that was no good to him.
Clemens 13, Bonds echoes.
I tell him about the other virus, the one that can put the undead back in their coffins where they belong. Dr. Oystein told us it was a standoff. He said that if he released Clemens 13, killing all the zombies, Mr. Dowling would release his sample of Schlesinger 10, dooming all of the humans in return. Now, based on everything I learned today, I guess it must have been the other way round, that Dr. Oystein was the one who wanted to unleash Schlesinger 10 and eradicate humanity. That's why he was so eager to retrieve Mr. Dowling's sample, not to neutralize it, but to use it.
I feel a lump in my throat as I give words to my thoughts. It hurts me, condemning Dr. Oystein out loud like this, but it's the truth, so how can I turn away from it? I've been fighting a war against evil ever since I linked up with the angels, but all this time the enemy had been in our midst, trying to trick us into helping him get his hands on the ultimate weapon.
What about this Clemens 13 you mentioned?
Bonds asks, distracting me from my melancholy.
Does Owlman or the clown have that too?
I scratch one of my metallic ears thoughtfully, finding it hard to focus. I'm not sure. I don't think they'd be bothered about it. I mean, even if Dr. Oystein released Schlesinger 10, they wouldn't use Clemens 13 against him because it would kill them too.
So nobody's going to use the Clemens 13 virus, Bonds presses.
I doubt it. Maybe the doc doesn't even have a sample anymore. Hell, maybe he never developed it in the first place.
That might have been a bluff to make us believe that he was on the side of the living.
Bonds thinks about that for a long time. I leave him to it. My head is hurting. I wasn't made for mental acrobatics of this kind.
Of course, this is all pure conjecture, he finally says, not content to let it lie. Any chance the doc might have been framed, or that you misunderstood him, that he really does want to help the living?
Possibly, I sniff.
Bloody unlikely, I'd say. But I didn't hear him out. I didn't dare. I was afraid he might convert me if I gave him a chance. Wise girl, Bonds chuckles, then makes a confused face. This is messed up. I've dealt with double crosses and intrigue for most of my life, but nothing on this scale.
It's simpler than it seems, I tell him. Schlesinger 10 is the key. Dr. Oystein used the zombie gene to bring the world to its knees. Now he's looking to get hold of the thing he needs to crush the last of the living completely.
Unless you've got the wrong end of the stick, Bond says.
Unless I've got the wrong end of the stick, I admit.
But where do you come into the equation? Bonds asks. Why does the doc want you so badly? It can't be just because you know about his true role in this. He would have told his angels to kill you if that was the case. But he gave them orders to bring you back alive.
I start to tell Bonds about my marriage to Mr. Dowling, but before I get to the part where I pinpoint the location of the vial of Schlesinger 10 and smuggled it out in the lining of my stomach, I have a nasty thought, and I pause. What if Bonds is here on Dr. Oystein's business? I'm pretty sure he's on the level. I think he really did help me because he likes me.
but I've been taken for a ride by an apparent good Samaritan before. Maybe it's a trick. Maybe Dr. Oystein told him to stage a betrayal, to con me into trusting him, so that I'd tell him what I did with the stolen vial. And I'm sure the Doc knows that I did steal it, because that's the only reason why Mr. Dowling would have invaded County Hall. This could be part of a cunning plan.
B, Bonds asks when I fall silent. I stare at the ex-soldier, wanting to trust him, but wary after what happened with the last person I had faith in. Should I take him in my confidence, or keep him at arm's length?
You know what? I mutter in the end. All this talking has made me hungry. I didn't realize how famished I was. Could I have more brains, please?
Barnes's eyes narrow. He can tell I'm suspicious. For a dangerous moment, I think he's going to attack me. But then he smiles and says,
What the hell? I might have a few more biscuits myself while we're at it. We deserve a treat after what we've been through.
He goes to fetch us some grub, leaving me to gaze at the back of his head and wonder miserably, Friend, a foe. Have I found sanctuary here, or walked into a trap of Dr. Oystein's making?
20. I don't need the extra helping of brains, but go through the motions, still mulling things over, trying to work out my next move. Whatever I decide, it will pay to keep Barnes on my side. As a zombie, I can't sleep. If I get the sense that something's rotten, all I have to do is play along, wait for him to nod off, and slip away while he's snoozing.
Barnes brews a mug of coffee and sips from it after finishing his biscuits. He's obviously not a dunker.
The offer still stands, you know, he murmurs over the rim of his mug.
What offer? I ask.
You can leave any time.
He nods towards the back door.
The boat's yours if you want it. You can sail off down the river by yourself. Go wherever your path leads you. I won't try to stop you. You're not beholden to me.
I wouldn't get very far on my own, I mutter.
Bullshit, Bond snorts. You'd get farther than just about anyone else I know, even though half of you has been snipped away. I'll give you all the brains that are stored here, and you have the syringes you took from Oystein to help top up your energy levels.
How do you know about those? I snap.
The doc told us. The twins had said you were dead on your feet, no pun intended. Oystein informed us that was no longer the case, warned us to be cautious.
I chew at my lower lip, studying Bonds's face for the least hint of a lie. He must see the worry in my gaze, because he smiles lazily and extends his hands.
Tie me up if you want, then make your getaway.
I stare at his hands and frown uncertainly.
Damn it, B, I can't make my position any clearer, he growls, losing patience. It's obvious you don't trust me, and I understand why you feel that way, but I'm not going to have you scrutinizing my every word and gesture. Accept me as an ally or cut me off and go your own way. But don't hang around and doubt me. I deserve better than that.
Do you? I ask bluntly. I risked my life for you, he snarls. I shrug. I didn't ask you to. His nostrils flare, and he points an angry finger at me. Then he squints. Takes a second to think about it and sighs.
You're right. You didn't. And I'm doing what I said I wouldn't, trying to persuade you to stay. Make up your own mind. I'm not going to try to charm you.
Bonds gets up, roots through a pile of books on a shelf, chooses one and sits again, opening it quietly and carefully, as if in a library. I watch him reading for a couple of minutes. It's some old spy novel. I think my dad had a copy of it at home.
Tell me I can trust you, I say softly.
No.
Bonds lowers the book slightly.
But I'll tell you this, even though I'm probably wasting my breath, I wasn't sure if life was worth living after I buried Stuart. I didn't sob or howl at the moon. That's not the sort of guy I am. But I sat in a quiet corner of a deserted church when I got back to the mainland, a can of beer in one hand, a gun in the other. And I thought long and hard about if I could be bothered carrying on.
Bonds goes back to reading the book, but his hands are trembling now. Not much, but a little, and I'm sure he's not concentrating on the words.
Why did you choose to continue?
I ask, remembering my own decision to end it all as I trudged away from County Hall, certain that everything was lost.
Believe it or not, I thought about you, Bonds replies. It wasn't intentional. I was sitting there remembering Stuart, mourning all that I'd lost, figuring there was no reason for me to go on fighting and struggling now that he was gone. Then, I found myself thinking about brave Becky Smith, how she didn't give in when she was a prisoner, how she fought the good fight, how she'd have surely been killed if I hadn't interceded and led the angels to her rescue. I knew she was the sort who was going to get into trouble again, and I had a niggling feeling she might need my help further down the line. I spent a long time drinking that beer, Bond says, his voice, a bare croak, trying to decide if helping you mattered to me that much. In the end, it was something I'd said to Stuart when I first left him on the island that swung it. He didn't want to stay. He didn't care that he was safe there. He cried and begged me to take him with me, said he couldn't stand it if I abandoned him and never returned. I told him that if he truly loved me, he wasn't to think that way. If I fell to the forces of darkness during my travels, I said the best way he could honor my memory was by living his life to the fullest. I told him to look for a father figure on the island, find someone who could take my place. He said he could never do that. I told him that if he didn't, it would mean he'd never loved me as much as he claimed. Bonds is still holding the book, but he's looking at the ceiling now. There are no tears in his eyes, but I think he's probably as close to them as he has ever been, or is ever likely to be. You're my replacement for Stuart, Bond says hoarsely. I lost my son, the only person on this dirt ball of a planet that I loved, and I've replaced him with a foster daughter, to do for him what I hope he would have done for me. I lived because of you, B. He finishes softly. If I can save you, I'll keep the ghost of my son alive a while longer. When I pass from this world, I'll take the last loving memory of Stuart with me, and I want to put that off for as long as I can. Protecting you gives me the willpower to endure the pain and heartache, to limp on when it would be so much easier to just stop. Bonds clears his throat and scowls. Believe me if you want, or believe I'm full of crap if you prefer. I don't give a damn. Just let me read my book in peace.
And, having said that, he returns his gaze to the novel and acts as if I'm not there, leaving me free to choose. 21. My dad died in Battersea Power Station, I murmur after a while. Bond squints.
What was he doing there?
He was in the Ku Klux Klan, one of their shining lights. The ex-soldier blinks.
I didn't know you were of racist stock.
Oh, yeah. The very worst. I used to be inclined that way myself once, eager to please my daddy.
And now? Bonds asks.
I smirk. These days I figure, live and let live. Bonds laughs out loud, then smothers it with a palm, not wanting to attract the attention of any sharp-eared zombies who might be lurking nearby. I'd like to have a father I could love and respect, I tell him when the fit of laughter passes.
B,
he says, his voice crackling with deep emotion. But since there's no one like that around, I suppose you'll do, I add. He shoots me the finger.
You're not what I expected from a daughter either, he chuckles.
What? I act shocked. I'm not Daddy's little princess.
Daddy's little monster, more like.
He smirks, then lays his book aside.
Does this mean you don't think I'm angling to betray you?
I'm giving you the benefit of the doubt, I mutter. For now.
I feel privileged, Bond says with a straight face. In that case, what's our next move? Since you didn't kill Oystein when you had the chance, I'm guessing you aren't interested in revenge.
Nah. What would killing him achieve? If he was just a nasty sod like Dandan, I might go after him. But someone who devotes his life to bringing down an entire species is a nutter of a different order. If I thought he still posed a threat, I'd have to act. But I'm pretty sure he can't do any more harm.
You're not concerned that he'll get hold of Mr. Dowling's vial of Schlesinger 10? Bonds asks.
No, I grunt, not telling him any more than that. I do trust him, but even so, there's no point being a silly bugger about it and sharing more than I need to.
So what next?
He asks again. Do you think you can fix me? I ask, pointing a finger at my shredded midriff. Bonds leans over and studies the damage.
looks at the stumps of my shorn-off ribs, the places where Mr. Dowling screwed in attachments that the babies later ripped away.
"How do you talk without lungs?" he asks.
"Mr. Dowling inserted a pump in my throat before he removed them," I explain. Barnes unwraps some of the bandages that are holding me together and surveys the rest of the damage, the holes in my arms and legs, my lacerated cheeks. His face saddens as he stares.
"Enough of the pity," I huff. "I don't need it." "They really did a number on you," he notes.
"Yeah, well, we can't do anything about that. I took the abuse and I'm still taking it. No point moping. Focus on my stomach. That'll be a major drawback if we can't patch it up."
"There's not a lot I can do," Bond says. "I'll wrap some fresh bandages round you. Proper bandages. Not these useless strips of cloth."
"Hey," I scowl. "They were all I had."
"And I guess they did the job," he admits. "But they're not the long-term solution. Tomorrow we'll screw in bolts to give you the rough shape of a rib cage, then cover them with a plastic sheet or a strip of leather. It needs to be something more durable than bandages, but easy to remove at the same time, because you'll have to go on eating like you did tonight, mashing up brains and smearing them in."
"Mr. Dowling was able to build an artificial digestive system for me," I sniff.
"Bully for him," Bonds retorts. "Go back to him if you were that impressed with his handiwork."
"What? And abandon my daddy?" I grin.
"Okay.
First we'll sort out my stomach. Can you fetch what you need in the morning?"
"Not a problem," Bond says. "I can have you ready to go before midday."
"Great. I'll need some new clothes, too. My dress is a wreck. Once I'm good for the road, we'll get the hell out of this place. I'm sick of London and the lunatics who control it. I want to get as far away as I can from Dr. Oystein, Mr. Dowling, and the rest."
"Do you have your sights set on anywhere in particular?" Bonds asks.
"New Kirkham," I reply instantly.
"I know that place," Bonds nods. "Coley and I swung through there a few times. Decent people for the most part, but some bad eggs in among the mix."
"It's changed since you last saw it. The racists made a play for power but failed. They were all hanged for mutiny. One of my friends helps run the town now. He'll give us shelter. We can draw up a more concrete plan, then set off into the wide blue yonder."
"Sounds good to me." Bond stretches and yawns. "Now, if you don't mind, I'm going to rid you of the rest of those old rags, wrap you up good and tight with clean bandages, do a bit more reading, then turn in for the night. You can keep watch. I might as well make use of you now that you're here."
"I'm not a god dog," I growl.
"Of course not," he says sweetly. "You're far uglier and way more vicious than any common mongrel."
"That's right," I huff. "Laugh it up. We'll see if you're so clever when I bring you your slippers in the morning and accidentally scratch your ankles when I'm helping you put them on."
Bonds laughs and says, "That's my girl."
"If only," I whisper to myself, remembering my real father and thinking what a pity it is that we don't get to choose who our parents are. If only. 22. A few hours later, Bonds is snoring lightly. He fell asleep almost as soon as he turned in. He told me that would be the case. He also said he's a light sleeper and would probably wake up if there were unusual noises, but even so, not to hesitate to disturb him if I thought there was a suggestion of trouble brewing. Bond sleeps in a sleeping bag on the bar, out of the way of any rats or insects. His guns rest close by, as well as a collection of knives. He didn't take off his boots or clothes, saying he liked to be able to hit the ground running. When I joked about his smell, he said it was no laughing matter. Zombies have an easier time sniffing out a clean human than a filthy one. I tried reading to pass the time, but I wasn't able to concentrate. I kept thinking about Dr. Oystein. What he's done to the world, why he hates the living so much. If there's even the slightest chance I might be wrong about him. Brooding about the past, worrying about the future. I want to go sit on the balcony, but I'd wake Bonds if I got up, even if I tried to tiptoe. He said not to worry, that he snaps awake several times most nights, but I don't want to be a disruptive guest. He came to my rescue today, when I was sure all was lost. So I want to repay him as best I can. Am I foolish to hope that things might work out?
Will Dr. Oystein anticipate my return to New Kirkham and send angels there ahead of me? Should we take a random route out of the city, avoiding any places that either of us have ventured to before? And afterwards, if we escape, where do I want to wind up? An island free of zombies? If so, what would I do about getting hold of fresh brains? Even if we could go somewhere by ourselves, where there was a ready supply of brains, surely Barnes would pine for human company. I'm limited in what I can give him. Conversation, yes, but we can't touch. No hugs or high fives. I can never give him a boost if he needs it. No contact sports. I'd even have to be wary playing a game of cards, in case I got excited, reached for a card at the same time as him and scratched him by accident.
Maybe I'll let Barnes go his own way, once he's escorted me to safety. Perhaps I could settle in a town or city in another country, where I could raid the morgues for years to come. Lonely but safe. Leave Barnes to live with others of his kind. Pop by for a visit every so often, to let him see that I'm okay, to cheer myself up. I don't contemplate suicide. That's off the agenda. I only toyed with that idea when I thought I was alone in the world. Now that I have someone who cares about me, who might need my help just as I need his, I'm giving no thought to my ultimate end. The grave can't have me as long as I have the interests of a friend to consider. I smile warmly in the dim light of the old pub, feeling like I've turned a corner, despite everything else that has happened. And that's when I hear a sniffing sound outside. 23. I'm too wise to the ways of the world to dismiss the noise. As soon as I hear it, I jerk bolt upright and hiss, "Barnes!" He wakes instantly, sits up, grabs a gun and looks at me questioningly. I point to my ears, then at the front door. Barnes slips out of the sleeping bag, slides off the bar counter, and stares at the door. We stand where we are, listening. I can't hear anything now, but I know the sound was real. Barnes slowly, softly crosses to my side and whispers, "What was it?"
"I'm not sure," I reply quietly. "Something snuffling. Maybe a zombie with a blocked nose, but it didn't sound like one."
"An animal?" Barnes asks.
"Possibly, but big if it was. Not a rat. More like a..."
I stop, suddenly realizing what the noise reminded me of. A dog. There are still dogs in London. They usually lie low at night, only coming out when the sun is up. I suppose some of them break that rule, creeping forth when it's dark, to forage for food if they feel like they can outwit or outrun the undead. Maybe the noise came from one of them. A hungry mutt on the prowl. But there's another type of dog. A unique specimen. One that has followed me before. As a wave of panic rises within me, I turn to Barnes and start to tell him that we have to get out of here immediately, that we must not take any risks. Before I can say a word, the lock in the door clicks as someone fiddles with it. "The balcony," Barnes says calmly, raising his rifle and pointing it at the front door.
"I think I know who it is," I mutter, grabbing a knife from the counter.
"Not a friend, I assume?" he says bleakly.
"No."
The door starts to open. Barnes pulls the trigger, and the top half of the door explodes into splinters. There's an angry howling noise. Some of the splinters must have caught the dog.
"Run!"
Barnes grunts, slowly backing up, ready to fire again if he catches sight of anyone. I hurry to the rear door, throw it open and step onto the balcony. I look around to make sure there's nobody waiting to pounce, then move to the edge of the platform to jump down into the boat. It isn't there. I stare at the spot where the boat should be, then out across the river. I spot it bobbing up and down in the middle of the Thames. There's a large, familiar figure on board. He waves heartily to me.
"Hi, Becky!"
Rage hollers.
"Fancy bumping into you here!"
Barnes hears and looks back at me.
"Are we screwed?"
"Pretty much," I growl. "Any other way out?" "The roof. There's a ladder on the balcony. Set it up and..."
"Becky!"
a man on the street shouts.
"This does not have to end badly. We can cut a deal."
"Who's that?"
Barnes asks.
Our man, I wince. The dog is Zacharias, his pet hound. It must have tracked my scent. I never anticipated that. I should have. It's not the first time the thing has hunted me.
No point blaming yourself now, Barnes says coolly.
The boat? Rage has taken it.
Is there anybody with him?
Not that I can see.
Do you think they're likely to have brought backup? He presses.
I've no idea, but hopefully not. I think I'd have heard more noises if the mutants were with them.
Barnes sniffs.
If it's just them, then it's 3-2 if you count the dog. Those are the sort of odds I like.
Becky!
Owlman calls again.
You won't gain anything if you try to run. I only want to chat. We'll let your friend walk away unharmed if you come out without a fight.
I'm going nowhere,
Barnes replies before I can answer. Then he whispers to me,
Scram. I'll stall them as long as I can.
No, I groan. I won't leave you.
You don't have a choice, he says.
Of course I do, I argue.
I can stay and fight.
Owlman pokes the front door open, and it swings inwards. Barnes fires again, but there's no one there.
Light from the moon spills into the bar.
Please, Becky, Owlman says.
I won't hurt you. If you value your partner's life, lay down your weapons and tell him to depart.
I look at Barnes and grimace. He's offering you a way out. I think he'll honor his pledge if I surrender.
I won't abandon you, Barnes says stiffly.
But we're trapped.
No, we're not. Get up on that roof and hot-foot it out of here like I told you.
And I told you I won't leave you.
Barnes glowers at me, then shrugs.
In that case, let's hit the street and take the fight to them.
Becky,
Owlman asks.
Give me a moment,
I call sweetly, then move ahead of Barnes.
What are you doing? He snaps.
The dog could rip your head off with one bite, and it can move quicker than anything you've ever seen. If you go first, Zacharias will attack.
What makes you think it won't attack you?
Barnes asks. They want me alive. I'll act as a shield, confuse them, buy you a few seconds. You can use that time to blow their stinking heads off.
Barnes grins grimly.
I like it. Okay, you lead, I'll follow. Just don't forget we're a team. I'll be watching your back all the way. Don't feel that you have to cut me loose to protect me. We escape or go down together, agreed?
You're the boss, Dad.
I smile. Barnes returns the smile, then slips up close behind me. We start to advance.
Oh, Becky, Owlman sighs, sensing rebellion in the air. If you had trusted me, we could have avoided this unpleasantness.
I do trust you, I shout cheerfully. I'm coming out now. I've laid down my weapons. Honest I have. And so has Barnes.
I'm nearly at the door. I get a firmer grip on my knife.
You think that you can fool me, but you're only making a fool of yourself,
Owlman says wearily. Then he clicks his tongue.
Here, Zacharias. I want you by my side. Good dog.
He raises his voice.
One last chance, Becky. Turn yourself over to us. Let Barnes walk away from this.
Ignore them.
Barnes growls in my ear.
They can't hurt us. Not if we work as a team.
Here we come, Owlie.
I chirp.
Time for tea and crumpets.
Silly girl, Owlman murmurs. Will you never learn?
He clears his throat and his voice changes, becomes deeper, more commanding.
I want you to do something for me, Becky.
Yeah?
I sneer.
What's that?
Kill Barnes.
I start to laugh, but before the sound can form, I find myself turning swiftly. Barnes isn't expecting it. He backs up and stumbles. My hand snakes out towards him. He probably thinks I'm trying to steady him, but he's wrong, because it's the hand holding the knife. And, as Barnes stares at me with shock and disbelief, I drive it through the side of his head, all the way up to the hilt.
24.
I let go of the knife and stare with horror at Barnes as he blinks dumbly, lips moving mutely. He reaches for the handle of the knife to pull it out, but his strength deserts him and he slumps. I catch him as he falls and lower him to the floor, moaning over him as he starts to shake. It doesn't take long for Barnes to die. His eyelids soon stop twitching, and his mouth goes still. I set his head down and turn it sideways. I'd like to pull out the knife and kill myself with it, but Barnes looks peaceful. I don't want to make a mess and disturb his body. I push myself to my feet and glance at the doorway. Owlman is standing there, Zacharias by his side. The dog is panting. Owlman looks grim. I throw myself at the bar, scrabbling for another couple of knives, one for the creep in the pinstripe suit, the other for myself. Stop! Owlman snaps, and I come to a trembling standstill. Hands by your sides, he commands, and my treacherous limbs obey. Owlman and his dog move into the bar. Zacharias trots over to Barnes and sniffs his face, making sure he's dead. Owlman stays focused on me.
You forgot that I could bend you to my will, didn't you? He asks softly.
I'll kill you, I snarl.
I will not give you the chance, he says, then sighs. I am sorry about the soldier. He might have proved a useful ally. You should have come out when I gave you the opportunity.
I try forcing my hands to rise, my feet to move, so that I can launch myself at Owlman and rip his face to pieces. But I'm a statue. He has complete control over me.
The end is nigh, Becky, Owlman says, coming closer, touching my left cheek tenderly. Our suffering is almost over. Once the final hand has been played, we can start afresh. It will be the beginning of a whole new era. Life will be easier for us then.
I'll kill you, I snarl again. Owlman tuts.
I could try to convince you to see things our way, but I know you would not heed my protestations. It is time for action, not words. However, before we push on, there's someone who has more faith in words than I do, and he would like an audience with you.
I stare questioningly at Owlman. In response, he points towards the door, and I realize someone is with him. A third figure steps into the room, a slight, neatly dressed man with graying hair, and a kindly face that has been recently scratched and bruised. I have to do a double take, because I never would have expected to see him in the company of Owlman, but there can be no mistake. It's Dr. Oystein.
You! I cry. What the hell are you doing here?
I nod at his large-eyed companion.
With him!
Why shouldn't I be with Tom White? Dr. Oystein replies calmly, referring to Owlman by his original name. He is, after all, my nephew. As I stare at the doc incredulously, mind reeling at the revelation that has been so casually tossed my way, he takes a seat, calmly runs a hand through his hair, and regards me solemnly.
Becky Smith, he says, heavily, it is time for you and I to have a little talk.
To be concluded.
Ready to sink your teeth into more of Darren Shan's chilling zombie series? Keep listening for a preview. Zombie Goddess. 1. Now. Dr. Oystein stares at me solemnly as I glare at him and try to break the spell that I'm under. But, as much as I strain and twitch, my limbs won't do what I want. Owlman is in command of my body, and I can't move until he frees me.
There is such ferocity in her expression, Owlman murmurs, running his fingers over his bulging stomach and pursing his lips. I think she would rip your head off if I released her.
No, Dr. Oystein says softly. She could have killed me in the brewery if she wished to end my life. I was at her mercy, but she spared me.
That was a mistake, I snarl, hating myself for what I've done to Barnes, hating Dr. Oystein and Owlman for making me do it. If the chance comes my way again...
Dr. Oystein sighs. He studies me sadly for a few seconds, then stands and fetches another seat. He positions it behind me and nods at Owlman.
You may sit, Becky, Owlman says, and I slide backwards onto the chair.
Dr. Oystein sits opposite me, hands resting on his knees. He looks tired, bloody and bruised from our fight earlier. Owlman stands just behind him. Zacharias pads across, lies by its master's feet, and closes its eyes. It looks like an ordinary sheepdog now. No sign of mutant claws or fangs. There's movement behind me. Rage enters by the back door, grinning wickedly. He must have rowed ashore and tied Bonds's boat back up at the pier. He spots the corpse and laughs harshly.
I bet our man made you kill him, Rage chuckles.
You'll be next, I promise.
Not as long as I'm a loyal servant, he says,
taking his place by our man's side, every bit as faithful as the snoozing dog on the floor.
Let me at him, I plead.
No, Owlman says. Besides, in your current condition, it would not be a fair contest.
That is why she asked you to let her fight, Dr. Oystein says. She wants him to destroy her brain, so that she can escape.
I do not blame her. After all that she has suffered, she deserves the relief of true death.
Fine words, I sneer. Back them up with action if you mean them.
I will, he says to my surprise. When we are done here, if you wish for me to execute you, I'll do that great and terrible thing. You have served my cause in ways no one else ever has, and I know you have paid a dreadful price. If oblivion is the reward you crave, I'll grant it. Release her, Zachary, Dr. Oystein says,
calling Owlman by his preferred title, even though the creep's real name is Tom White. Owlman looks uncertain.
Are you sure that's wise?
I think that she is ready to listen to us now,
Dr. Oystein says. If not, you can always reassert your authority over her.
Very well. Owlman waves a hand at me. You're free, he says,
and I feel myself relaxing back to normal. As soon as my limbs are my own, I hurl myself at Dr. Oystein, fingers clawing for his eyes.
Stop!
Owlman barks, and I freeze.
Sit,
he says, and I return to my chair.
It seems that you were right and I was wrong, Zachary,
the doc notes glumly.
Sorry, I mutter. It was a knee-jerk reaction. Let me go. I won't do it again, I promise.
Owlman cocks an eyebrow at Dr. Oystein. The doc doesn't hesitate, nodding immediately.
Very well, Owlman says.
You're free again, Becky.
I'm out of my chair even before he's finished saying my name, and this time I almost get my hands on an unflinching Dr. Oystein before Owlman exerts his control over me and once more sends me back to the chair.
It's hopeless, Oystein, he says. The girl is beyond reason.
So it seems, the doc murmurs. Yet I would try with her, Zachary, again and again. She is worth so much more than you or I, and I hate what we have done to her.
He grimaces. But we don't have all night. I will leave her a prisoner of your wishes for the time being.
Ever the gent,
I sneer, then glare at Owlman. I hate this tall man in the striped suit, with his pot belly and abnormally large eyes, but I'm impressed at the same time.
How the hell do you do this anyway? The doc said you hypnotized me when I was a kid. Is that true?
I certainly hypnotized you, Owlman purrs. But more recently than that, I did it when you returned from your first encounter with one of Olbrecht's babies, after it had killed your artist friend. I think back.
You mean when I was in the groove tube?
That was a long time ago. I was in bad shape then, though nowhere near as bad as I am now, and had to spend a few weeks immersed in the restorative liquid, in a blissed-out, unconscious state.
I couldn't hypnotize you while you were in a state of suspension, Owlman says.
But I did it not long afterwards. When you were fished out and told Dr. Oystein what had happened with the baby, he could see that you were a crucial player in his war with Mr. Dowling. He asked me if I would establish a control mechanism, so that we could study you if we thought that you were going astray. He led you out of County Hall and brought you to me, so that I could work my charms on you. At the end of our many sessions together, I told you to wipe the memory of our encounter from your thoughts. That is why you have no recollection of it.
So you were in league with Owlman even then?
I spit at the doc.
Of course, he says glumly.
as I told you, Zachary is my nephew. We have had our differences over the years, and it was important that certain individuals believed we were still on confrontational terms, but we have been cooperating closely for a long time now, as you will have seen in the records that you found in the brewery.
They made for cheery reading, didn't they? Rage snorts.
You read them too? I frown.
Sure, he says. I went there the night that we got back from New Kirkham, while the rest of you were guarding Dandan in the suburbs. I had a feeling there was more to what happened with your old teacher, Billy Burke, than met the eye.
I remember that night, Rage sneaking out, looking ashen when he returned, sitting apart from the rest of us, brooding. A conversation we had in Battersea comes back to me. He told me to make for Brick Lane to look for answers. I'd forgotten all about that, at least on a conscious level.
That's when I decided to switch sides, Rage goes on. The doc had tricked me, made me think there might be truly decent people out there, that they had a chance of changing the world for the better. I started to think that I could be a hero. But then, I saw he was a liar. To be honest, I was relieved when I found out that the doc was as twisted as the rest of us. It freed me to go back to the way I was.
Dr. Oystein says nothing to defend himself while Rage is criticizing him. I find myself getting hot under the collar. I want to tell Rage to shut up, that he's got no right to criticize a man of Dr. Oystein's caliber. Then I think about what I learned earlier tonight. I remind myself that even though I don't want to believe it, and as much as it pains me to admit it, my beloved mentor is a villain beyond compare, and I keep my mouth closed.
We have so much to discuss, the doc says. This is a night for revelations. I have told you many lies in the past,
or subtly distorted things that were true.
No more. I will be honest with you in this final stretch. All that I can share, I will. But first, I must know about the vial.
Zachary?
He glances back at Owlman. It is vital that she answers honestly.
Becky, Owlman says, tell us the truth.
I feel my jaw tighten, my tongue no longer quite my own.
Dr. Oystein leans forward tensely.
Did you discover where Mr. Dowling was storing his vial of Schlesinger 10? I want to lie, to prevent him from finding out what has happened to the virus that could wipe out the whole of humanity if released. But I can't.
Yes,
I groan.
Did you go in pursuit of it?
Dr. Oystein presses. Again, I'm forced to answer truthfully.
Yes.
And did you take it? He hisses.
Yes,
I grunt.
I wedged it into my stomach and fled with it inside me.
The doc's eyes sparkle as brightly as the undead's ever can. He lurches forward, as if to rip through the bandages that Barnes wrapped round me. Then he stops himself and sits back, smiling warmly.
No, that can wait. We are relatively safe here. We have some time to play with. Let us talk first. Then we will attend to other matters.
The doc licks his lips, looks at the bandages again, then strokes his chin and casts his thoughts back.
Where to begin?
He muses aloud. We cannot go down every trail. My full story would require weeks to tell, but I will try to cover the key points as swiftly as I can. I suppose I should commence with a tale that I partly shared with you before, about when I was a prisoner of the Nazis.
This has been a Hachette audio production of Zombie Fugitive, written by Darren Shan, read by Emma Galvin, produced by Elise Green, recorded at Audio Media Production, post-production by Audio Media Production. Zombie Fugitive is also available in print and digital formats from Little Brown & Company, a division of Hachette Book Group. For more Hachette audio productions, visit us at hachetteaudio.com. Thank you for listening. Text copyright 2015 by Home of the Damned Limited. Audio production copyright 2016, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Excerpt from Zombie Goddess, copyright 2015 by Home of the Damned Limited. Audio production copyright 2016, Hachette Audio, all rights reserved. Hachette Book Group supports the right to free expression and the value of copyright.
The purpose of copyright is to encourage writers and artists to produce the creative works that enrich our culture. The duplicating, uploading, and distribution of this book without permission is a theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like permission to use material from the book, other than for review purposes, please contact permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights. This audiobook is a work of fiction. Names, characters, places, and incidents are either the product of the author's imagination or are used fictitiously, and any resemblance to actual persons, living or dead, events or locales, is entirely coincidental.